they had a baby.
I open up the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Housing on Thursday, November 21st, 2013. And we're going to be hearing from the Early Learning Council.
Jada Rupley.
Are you bringing anybody with you, Jada?
I'd like to introduce them just standing up. And
sure.
Better
great.
Than doing this solo.
Good. Okay.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, committee members. Thank you very much for inviting me back. I do appreciate this is the committee that I met my very first time last year, not so long ago, and appreciate your continued interest in the work of the Early Learning Council. What I would like to do is part of the work that we've done is we have some key staff members that have joined the team and are working with both Race to the Top and the Early Learning Hubs. And I would like for Krista Shively, who is the program and policy person doing the Race to the Top and all of those initiatives that you're going to hear about me from me. You also have Megan Irwin, who is the Early Learning System Design Manager, and she is doing the Early Learning Hubs. And a third member of our team, however, not part of the Early Learning Division, but one of the things that we wanted to let you know about our connection to healthcare is Dr. Dana Harganani. Dana works for Bruce Goldberg in the Oregon Health Authority and sits on our Early Learning team, which is very important to the work that we're doing. Thank you very much for having me, and I want to start with the connection to healthcare. One of the things that we all know is healthy children are, and their families are one of the goals for the Early Learning Council to be able to look at, as well as in that kindergarten readiness. And when you hear Dr. Bruce Goldberg say that one of my goals is kindergarten readiness, he doesn't mean that he's going to be in there doing reading, math, and skill sets. What he's really doing, and that's the work of Dana, is early identification of kids who need continued services, as well as healthy and attached families, are the most important things for kids and families to come to school successfully. The Early Learning Council, along with the Health Policy Board, have adopted a universal screening that will be done with both healthcare providers and early providers, and it is called Ages and Stages. It's an Oregon-grown instrument, and it's very easy. It's designed to be given by health providers, by early learning providers, as well as parents, grandparents, and whoever might do that. So it's one of those great beginning tools for all to use. I want to talk also about the quality rating improvement system that is with licensed child care providers throughout the state. The Early Learning Council met last week, and we have conducted a field test in four regions of the state, and you do have that on your handout. They're Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson, Lynn, Benton, Lane, Douglas, and Multnomah. We were excited because we awarded the first 13 three-star, four-star, and five-star providers who have been working on that for this year. The five-star provider was one that we went to visit. It's a Montessori school in Portland, and we had a lot of fanfare. We got to see a wonderful facility, and the takeaway for the council as well as staff is that we would like to see that available for every child in Oregon across the state. So that is one of the things that we will be working with our Race to the Top to be able to do. In our connection to the K-12 world, the kindergarten assessment rolled out in the fall, and we have, as we speak, over in the public services building in a joint effort with the Department of Education, a kindergarten interpretive panel, and we have 30 plus folks from across the state spending time with us to tell us what went well, what didn't go well, what things that they need us to look at differently. It is kindergarten teachers, it is early learning providers, there are parents there. There are the research folks from the universities. And yesterday was a great day, and we expect more as they look at the data that they had. And I think that one of the things next year, this time, what we know is that by now, the results of the kindergarten assessment will be in the hands of parents and teachers. That has been one of our issues this year, is that we haven't gotten that feedback back as quickly as we would have liked. Pre-K alignment, early literacy investments, ensuring that children read by third grade in the strategic initiatives that you as the legislature did as House Bill 3232. There was an early reading initiative, and we are working, we worked with a stakeholder group to develop criteria to be able to roll that out in grants to the field in both early learning providers and those that are interested in looking at closing the achievement gap. We are working similar to what the Department of Education did in helping with grant writing, because one of the things that we know from many areas is that there were a lot of pots of money that rolled out, and there was an extreme amount of hardship upon organizations looking at competitive grants. So we're trying to make this as easy as possible and give them the assistance to be able to do that. We also have a Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Fund that the Early Learning Council jointly met with the Oregon Education Investment Board to take the statute that was put into place and move forward to create a competitive application for that. I also wanted to tell you that we are working further, and we will know more as you come in back into the February session, is Oregon was part of a 9-state consortium to look at formative assessments and checkpoints between kindergarten, first grade, second grade, all the way to third grade reading, so that you don't just have a snapshot assessment that we have with kindergarten and then not know what we're doing until we have third grade reading scores. And it's designed to change curriculum. North Carolina is the lead, and we know that we will be informed by some great work that they are moving forward to do. These are not, again, what I want to make sure to say, they are not high-stakes testing. These are really to inform the adults, help for us to how to change our instruction and our practice. I think that the award of the Early Learning Hubs also happened last week, and there was one award to Marion County, and Marion County was given an award as their application stands. The council also awarded 5 additional conditional grants throughout the state, depending on some negotiation. What we found is there were some applications that show great community work. There were some issues in terms of some of the work with equity and serving those most in need, as well as some partnership things. So we begin negotiation with those 5, and then we are scheduled to go back in the February meeting to the council to do those awards upon completion of a successful negotiation. Those will include community visits as well as contract negotiations with them. So that's my report. I would love to have any questions, concerns that you all hear, because I know that you may have those.
Great. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jada, thank you for coming. I know that last fall, kind of in the rollout, there's been some tension around early intervention and early childhood special ed, since that's not so much a human service program but an education program under federal rules. And I think there's been a lot of progress towards building that trust, but there's a couple of outstanding things that I wondered if you could talk more about. There was some concern that at the Early Learning Council last week, it was announced that the ELC would now be approving the SICC slots, and that's caused some significant concern, since the SICC is supposed to be making recommendations about whether or not to be have rulemaking under the ELC. And the other concern that's been raised is whether or not the SICC is now allowed to have stakeholder meetings without the approval of the ELC. There's a concern that they're not able to talk to their stakeholders. How much of that is misunderstanding, and can you help speak to what's going on with all of that and the independence of EIECSE as is
suggested? All those letters.
Yeah. So early intervention, early childhood special ed.
Got that one.
And the State Interagency Coordinating Council, which is a statutory advisory council made up of parents and educators and others to advise the governor and the Department of Ed related to services for young children with disabilities. And I think the slots in question were parent slots. People were concerned about being able to vet their own parent slots.
I'd be glad to. Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, last week at the Early Learning Council, what happened was in my director's report, there were two positions that the Early Learning Council needed to fill. There was a position that was the Commission on Children and Families that the governor asked us to fill with a council member, because the governor does appoint those positions. And the second one was one of the other council members, Krista Rood, who now serves as the Head Start Collaboration Director. So that is what we were having the conversation about, were those two positions that will join the SICC. I'd like to think that there isn't the tension that you just described, because we actually have had from the Department of Ed, Nancy Johnson-Jordan has been also sitting on our leadership team, working with all of us on the early learning initiatives. And so I think that there may be a little bit of misunderstanding in terms of how those reappointments would happen and things like that. And so I actually worked with Duke Shepherd in the governor's office to make sure that those can go forward to the governor for reappointment. So I would be glad to reach out to anyone who has that misunderstanding, but I don't think we're doing anything differently than what you think we should be doing.
And as a follow-up, I think it would be helpful maybe to reach out to the SICC. I think the way that that was interpreted was that you would be selecting all of the slots, the parent slots, the educator slots, and it's created a lot of tension. And I think especially in combined with some concern about being able to have stakeholder meetings and needing to get ELC approval first, because SICC, I think the folks feel like they are a statutorily independent committee and should be able to meet with their stakeholders under their own governance structure.
And Representative Tomei and Kelser, excuse me, Chair Tomei, is I totally agree with that. I don't have any interest in doing any more appointments or staffing any more committees. So I think that what I would like to do is I think I had an email from their chair, who is Diana, and I can't think of her last name, and so I will do that follow-up, and I'll follow up with you, too, to make sure I do what I need to.
And the meetings, I didn't hear you say, may they meet with their stakeholders?
I don't even know what that part is, so okay. I think I probably would say sure.
Thank you.
Kenny Geyer.
Hi. Thank you, Jada. I know we were supposed to meet right before this, and I'm sorry that I missed that. So some of these questions are the first time you're hearing. This basically has to do with the Readiness for Kindergarten Innovation and Partnership Grant. And I recognize that you are on an incredibly fast timetable trying to get this and the early literacy and the hubs and everything up and going. And I believe, I'd love to hear more about the process, but I want to lay out a couple of the concerns so that you can address that.
Okay.
I believe that on October 25th, you sent out, OEIB sent out a public notice of a conference call for October 31st that was an hour long to get feedback for the criteria for these partnership grants. I believe that because I, as long as I'm reading correctly, that your public notices. There are a number of groups who either missed that, couldn't participate, whatever. I've had very little ability over yesterday when we had lots of hearings to really follow up and understand the nature of the concerns. But I'm hearing from several groups that they didn't feel very consulted in the criteria that was put out. I'm hoping that this criteria was preliminary and that there can be a more full public process about it. Some of the groups were involved in helping develop the criteria for the early literacy grants, felt really good about that, and thought that they would be called in to help develop the criteria for this, and they were not. Christy Cox, Mary Louise McClintock, and others. There's another group, as you know, of superintendents around the state. I believe there are about 30 of them that are really working hard to look at how do they connect their kindergartens and their elementary schools to early learning. They're a policy group, and I believe they just wrote a letter. And I'll just say just one piece of it. Our work group has identified two significant barriers with respect to successful implementation of full-day kindergarten and early childhood programs, specifically the assurance of adequate and stable funding for early learning and serious facilities limitations are of great concern to all superintendents. It's our desire to work together with the Oregon Education Investment Board and Early Learning Council. Connecting early learning and K through 12 will not come easy, and strong partnerships will certainly be an integral part of this process. Signed by the the co-chairs, John Peterson, who I think is Pendleton, and Mary Alice Russell. These are people from around the state who really want to connect with you and help be a part of the criteria. And I think you know, and I've said before, that my hope for this process is that we continue to follow the tight, loose philosophy that we've done in the CCO development and everything else, where we notice that there's a real need to connect early childhood programs to kindergartners, to kindergarten and elementary schools, and that we, while we are very clear about the end goals, that we really allow, through learning hubs, through collaborations with schools, we allow them to identify what the greatest needs are. And facilities are certainly a huge part of it. And so the elimination of being able to use any kind of funds for capital construction, whether it's for new construction or to remodel things so that you can have smaller toilets or anything else, seems really limiting, number one. So I'm concerned about the outcome. But even more than that, I'm concerned that we really make sure that we engage all of the people beyond an hour-long conference call. So please, I know very little. I only know a few things, and I'm sorry I missed our opportunity to talk. So would love to hear how you're addressing those concerns. Okay.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kennegeier. We're talking about the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Grant, which was a $4 million grant that was put into the House Bill 2013. The group that you're talking about that met on October 30th was a joint group between the OEIB and the ELC, so they had appointed members that met together. Those members were Hannah Vandering from the Oregon Education OEA, and it was Marlene Yasquin, who is a board member in Medford, as well as an Early Learning Council member, Dr. Mark Mulvihill, and Pam Curtis. What that group did during the which was a public meeting, and it was noticed, and it was a phone call, is they created the criteria to present to the joint board, so we also had a joint meeting between the OEIB and the ELC. And I think it's important to note that what we see going on in communities is communities are working together. As many of those times, there are not those barriers, but what we wanted to do was role model from the very top level that you had your policy boards also working together on this criteria. If you, and I'll be glad to get copies of this, is if you look to see, it took basically from the statute as well as from the fiscal impact from the LFO. And one additional criteria was added, and that is the fact that these funds in the $4 million, which we feel is a very small fund, could not be used for capital. Is the committee felt strongly, and that was a discussion that happened, is innovation was probably not buildings in terms of what you wanted to accomplish with programs looking at that. What they also recognized to a board member is that there is not enough ability for capital facilities to happen in the state of Oregon, and they were truly committed to be able to help with that in other funds that are more specifically addressing capital money, and especially as you look at full-day kindergarten coming in and the partnerships that we're expecting them to do. But this fund, they felt, was not the place to do that. The council, actually, chair and myself have already had a conversation with John Peterson and Mark Mulvihill, and they are, we have offered to meet with the vision group to be able to look at how that can move forward and how we can help them in other ways as we look at how we get capital facilities through other funding sources. So I think they're also... is the rulemaking that will happen in December and January, so that will be additional time for additional input from the communities across the state.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what we've just heard. Mm-hmm. My comment is that it's interesting. I mean, I've been here a year like you, so what I've learned or observed, I should say, in this year is that with all of these initiatives in various institutions in the state, it's very exciting. But again, this problem of silos and lack of communication seems to be pretty consistent. And so, you know, I think that's just a nature of change. But it seems obvious to me that we really need to address that concern around communication in terms of stakeholders and people that are anxious out there. So,
Chair Toomey, Representative Gallegos, we totally agree. And one of the things that I know moving forward is that when I addressed you when you first met, it was me and one other person. And so I don't really like to think about the addition of staff, but truly to get the work done and do that communication, it's one of those critical elements that we're able to go do. And then, as you know, the hubs were the major redesign that we were looking at for early learning. And so you had a competitive process, which also kept us from having those communications with communities. So you will see us out working hand in hand with all of these programs moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Jay, just two simple little questions, and I won't blow them out. Representative Guy, or no, Kenny Geyer, that was for you, too. Okay. I appreciate the piece of information here that you have for the Oregon early learning childhood piece. The pre-K third alignment, where you have the piece on the reading at grade level, third grade. Where's writing fit into all that? I mean, I know you got a big focus on the reading part, but I'm just curious, too, where writing fits into that.
Chair Toomey, Representative Olson, if you think about when we talk about reading, it's usually called literacy, and if you look at that, you have reading and writing and all of the elements that we probably talked about in terms of those arts together. So early learning, basically, when they learn their letters, they learn how to write their letters, and so that's just part of the process, and I don't think it's called out specifically. Is there something else that you have further that you'd like to make sure we know on the writing part?
No, there was something we'll talk about on the side.
Okay.
The other thing, too, is that you mentioned about the five hubs, too, pending. What five are those?
Oh, right down at the bottom where it says early learning hubs. I'm sorry, I should have said it. I was in a hurry. Yeah. So you have Marion that we talked about.
Okay.
Lane. Okay, right there.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. Colleagues, are running over time, so thank you so much, and we'll have you probably again in January. We might have time for a longer hearing.
I look forward to it, and thank you very much, and I will follow up with each of you on the concerns you've expressed.
Thank you so much. Moving along, we have Senate Bill 964, update. We'll have Lois Day and Stacy Lake. Thank you for coming this morning. Is this going to be the only machine that we're going to have this morning? Anybody else going to be using this?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Go ahead, Lois.
Good morning, Chair Toomey, members of the committee. My name's Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director of the Department of Human Services, and with me today is Stacy Lake, who is our Manager for Differential Response and Senate Bill 964, our shortened name for Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families Programs Manager. We do have a PowerPoint that we'll move through. We may not hit every slide, but we wanted to make sure you had full information about the three agendas, really, that we're driving right now, or initiatives that we're driving right now to transform the child welfare program. And I wanted to just say as an aside that we've experienced a wonderful partnership with the Early Learning Council since they came on board. We have met several times and had conversation around where our programs intersect in communities and which populations of children we share in common, and really have tried to not silo. I just wanted to let the committee know around this early learning and safety for the most vulnerable children in our community. So we know that's going to continue. Now I'm going to show my technological lack of savvy, but I may not get this right on. This is just a reminder that in the child welfare system, we have an agenda of the safe and equitable reduction of the number of children who experience foster care in Oregon. We've had some success, which is at the end of the PowerPoint, some of our data indicating that we have reduced our foster care population, and we want to do that more. We want a further reduction. But we're very clear that the reduction needs to be in an environment where children are safe or safer than they would be if they're experiencing foster care, and that it be done in a way that it pays attention to the disproportionate representation of children of color that currently exist in our system and the need for services and supports for those families so that they can keep their children at home as well. So this is just a refresher for the committee around our overall agenda. I would add that in the fourth bullet where it talks speaks to the health, education, and overall well-being of children fathering care, that includes our desire to eliminate any abuse that may occur in foster care as well. So the three primary strategies we have right now achieve that overall strategy are on this slide. They include refreshing and strengthening our Oregon safety model. We implemented our model some time ago, and we really wanted to go back and refresh people's understanding of the elements of the model, because it's really important that we be practicing with fidelity to the model in order to be successful with our differential response implementation. And we're doing that through our management staff. We're refreshing the training for our supervisors, our line supervisors, and providing them with individual coaching, and they're going back with that training to their units and then refreshing the line workers that are in their units. And we have a continuation of that coaching available for them when they're doing that and actually interacting with the cases that are on the caseloads in their unit. The second strategy is the implementation of strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families programs. This was legislation that was passed in 2011, and it contemplates a comprehensive service array in communities that can catch families where they need to be caught. We're going to speak in more detail to that, but it really is about bringing communities together in a collaborative way to identify the gaps in the service array they currently have and filling those gaps so that they have a full service array for these families. And then the third strategy is to implement differential response, which is we're going to speak more about that later on in the PowerPoint, but that really gives families a greater voice in the case when they come to the attention of the department. And it also is good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative.
Morning. I certainly didn't want to interrupt anything. I almost want to clap.
He drove all the way from Seattle, so no nasty remarks.
Okay. This is just a graphic representation of how these three strategies really fit together. The safety model is the underpinning, really, of all of our work, and it is a model based on safety of children in their home, in our system, throughout the life of the case. It's also, I'll say, it's not based on risk. The way I describe it is that there's risk everywhere in childhood, and really the ability of the adults that surround children to have protective capacities is what mitigates that risk so children are safe, and that's what our safety model is based on. The other two parts of this triangle are the 964 services that we're pushing out to the communities, and that's more of the external piece to this triangle, and on the other side is implementation of differential response, which is really an internal redesign of the child welfare response system. Those three together, we believe, are going to push us further in our ultimate goal to reduce the foster care population safely and equitably.
How do you engage the community providers?
How do we engage community providers?
Yeah, and how do you identify the service gaps?
We're going to talk about that. That legislation, we'll talk about some of the elements of that legislation.
Right.
It's actually a pretty complex legislation when you actually dig into it, and a piece of it is the engagement piece.
Okay, thank you.
So if we don't cover it, please come back to us. Thank you. So the Oregon safety model really is about safety assessment at the beginning of a case and then management of that safety for children at every stage of the case, from screening through case closure. There's an emphasis on child safety, not simply on child safety in terms of family functioning, not just in terms of whether or not an incident of abuse occurred. So it's a broader look at the safety. And it includes a comprehensive assessment of the family. And within that comprehensive assessment is where we do an identification of the protective capacities that are, in essence, either not present or weak in the family that causes a lack of safety. And that identification then follows through with the services that the family may access in terms of bolstering those protective capacities. We'll speak about that again in our contracting, which is also part of that legislation. We also, in that assessment, identify conditions for safety that might allow us to leave the child in the home. And if we can't leave the child in the home, through that assessment, we identify conditions for return that would allow us to leave the child in the home. Both of those are based on safety, not risk or completion of services, but can we put things in the home that bolster those protective capacities so the child can stay there safely? And finally, it focuses on safety threats using a sort of a safety threshold criteria, not a risk criteria. People have asked why we're changing our safety model with differential response, and I just want to state we're not. Really, differential response is an enhancement of the safety model because it allows an additional approach to be used in working with families, but it's all based on the safety model we have in place. And this speaks to what I said earlier around how we're strengthening the understanding and application of our model through additional training of our management staff and the intensive field consultation or coaching resources for them as they train their workers. And I'm going to hand it over to Stacy now for discussion of 964 and differential response.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, committee members. My name is Stacy Lake. I'm going to talk with you a little bit. I just want to start off with we have developed a vision statement for our differential response work here in Oregon, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, but just wanted to point out that it's congruent with the safe, equitable foster care reduction goals that Ms. Day mentioned in the beginning. And this vision statement was developed by a design team that was brought together that was made up of DHS staff of all levels from across the state, as well as stakeholders that were brought to the table, such as providers, parents, tribal representation, etc. And I'm going to talk more about differential response in a few minutes. So I want to talk a little bit about the Senate Bill 964 services and how that's going. We have those services in place in 8 counties in the state right now. So that's Tillamook, Clackamas, Malheur, Josephine, Jackson, Umatilla, Multnomah, and Coos. And we have 2 more counties that are very close. They're in the process of executing contracts, and that's Washington and Deschutes counties. So our plan is to have these services in place across the state by May of 2014. I just want to talk a little bit about the gaps and needs analysis that you were asking about. How do we bring the partners to the table in our communities? How do we determine what those gaps and needs are? And so different communities are doing that in different ways. They're bringing their county partners, they're identifying their county partners, bringing them to the table, bringing community stakeholders that have a stake in their child welfare-involved families in their communities, and really getting at trying to determine what are the gaps and needs and services in our particular community around supporting child welfare-involved families in maintaining children safely at home, getting children home more quickly, providing culturally competent services, and all the other parts of the statute. One of the ways or some of the examples and how they're getting that input from their community is some of them are doing focus groups, some are doing surveys, some are using the meetings that they already have in place with their county partners, and they're really just talking through their particular community needs.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, what I would add to this is that a piece of the legislation requires us to come together in a collaborative fashion, and while that may seem like just a word, really it's fundamentally different to call a meeting than it is to have a collaboration. And that collaboration requires creating relationship and having some shared values. And so we ask them to start with information around the families that are actually coming to the child welfare system and have, before they start saying, well, we know what service here we need to get, really have conversation around that population and their needs and what's driving people into the child welfare system in an effort to create that relationship so they have the shared values and understanding before they start doing the gap analysis. So that, on this next slide, I know that Stacy's going to talk about that. That speaks to why we have a multi-month process to actually identify gaps, identify the services, and get contracts in place. It's creating that collaboration. And different counties have had different experience with that in the past. I know we've spoken in the past about our collaboration with Casey Family Programs and our working communities to bring together collaborations. Those counties are ahead of some other counties in their ability to do that. So it takes some time. That is the bottom line.
Yes, and I would say that we learned a lot from the first seven counties that that went through this process. And as a result, we've created an orientation process for the newer counties so that they don't have to do so much of that learning each time on their own. So the chart that you're seeing up there, as Ms. Day mentioned, shows a multi-month process from really that orientation process with the counties to contract execution. And we've talked a bit about all of the things that are occurring during those months. And the time can vary depending on how the communities decide to contract, how they reach out to providers maybe in their community that they haven't contracted with before. So they're really trying to get creative about filling those service gaps. If you'll go to the next one. So I just want to highlight some of the wide range of services that counties have contracted for thus far. So I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. Housing has come up again and again as a gap in many of the communities across the state thus far, and that includes emergency, short-term, long-term, but they're all provided with supportive services in place, so really working to help keep families housed because that seems to be the biggest challenge. We've also, I'll just highlight one other, and that's the front end and support services, and that's really providers and child welfare collaborating at the beginning when they go out and meet with families during that child protective services assessment.
And Chair Tomei, members of the committee, the joint going on the initial visit with families is part of the legislation that we are able to take with us service providers who have expertise in the area that's challenging the family based on the report we receive with us into the field for that initial engagement.
So the only other thing I'd add about that front-end intervention is that it's also critical, as you'll see in a few minutes, to our differential response model. So here's just some more details about our Senate Bill 964 services and some definitions attached to those. So another service that we're seeing come up as a need in many of the communities are navigator services, so really helping families navigate the multiple agencies that they're needing assistance from. It could also be as simple as I heard a navigator give us an example of some of the help that they were giving to a family, and they actually helped the family navigate the transportation system in the community. They were having a hard time getting to their mental health appointments, and the navigator went to the house, helped the family take the bus and get where they needed to get that day. So it's really about meeting that particular family's needs. And here are some more examples of of some of the services that are being put into place. And I'll just mention here that we are working towards moving away from an output-based only contracting process. So outputs are really looking at how many families we're serving, how long we're serving them, or how many times we may be seeing them. And while that's important and we will keep that part of the process, we're moving towards looking more at outcomes. How are these services in particular helping families achieve what's needed. So as Ms. Day mentioned earlier, our focus is really looking at enhancing families or parents' protective capacities, and how are the services that we're putting in place achieving that.
Another piece of the legislation is the option for the department to enter into performance-based contracts, and that's a piece we're working on. Again, we have a provider population that has not had performance-based contracts in the past, and so I think there's a certain amount of concern around how that might impact their service delivery. So where we're starting is, again, having the conversation around what is our goal in providing this service and basing it on the Oregon safety model. What are the protective capacities you believe you're going to be able to enhance through the provision of this service? And that would be the outcome we're seeking from that particular service. There's some complexity of that when we talk to the providers, because some communities have decided to have an umbrella organization that has all the services underneath, and so we'll have a single contract with that organization. And for that community, we can talk about outputs in terms of how many children you serve leave the foster care system and how many remain at home, some of our larger, more global outcomes that we're attempting to reach. Other communities have elected not to have an umbrella organization, but a consortium, if you will, of services, and those conversations, there's multiple contracts in those counties, and we have to have conversation with each contractor around which protective capacity enhancement does your particular program impact, and then really measure that outcome from them, and then look at the total outcomes we have in that community for our more global goals of reducing entry and preventing entry. So it's a new landscape, if you will, for both child welfare and the provider community that we've been contracting with for a number of years. But I think people are on board and we're getting there, and hopefully we're going to have some really strong information for you around the impact of these programs on our families and our ultimate goals.
Well, the last thing I'll mention about the Senate Bill 964 services is they're really about building capacity in the communities to serve the families in their own communities. And some of the early counties have found, while they identified needs and gaps early on, they're revisiting those periodically to make sure those are still needs and gaps in their communities. And one community in particular recently relooked after about a year and determined that the demographics of the children there were serving had shifted. So that community in particular, they started a service that was aimed at serving youth, and even though the child welfare agency in that community didn't need those services as much anymore, the community felt like it was a really important service, so they found other ways to continue to fund that service. So that's just a really good example of how these services are actually building capacity for the future.
Another example, I think, is that there are a number of counties that that did not have relief nurseries and now are bringing relief nurseries on board, in part through our ability to contract for that particular type of service. And while we can contract for the families that are in our system, the existence of a relief nursery in a community that didn't have one in the past is enhanced capacity, and partners are able to come around and look to how they can finance additional slots for children who don't hit our system, which frankly will probably keep them from coming into our system. And so these dollars are stretching further. They're being leveraged in different ways in communities to enhance the service array for all families.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about differential response, and I know we've been before this committee before, so I'm not going to go into as much detail.
According to my schedule, we have about 5 minutes left, so if you could just finish up really quickly, and then we'll open up to some brief questions.
Okay. Why don't we move to the common principles? Okay, so I just wanted to highlight the common principles between the traditional and the alternative approaches. Just as a reminder, differential response is about having two tracks, two ways of serving families that have screened in reports of abuse or neglect and will be having CPS assessments. So the common principles are, in either track, safety is our primary responsibility and our primary goal for children, as well as well-being and permanency within the family whenever that's possible. There's also that recognition that if a child is not safe, Child Protective Services needs to take action to ensure that that child's safe, no matter which approach a family served. There's also an acknowledgement that families that are able to maintain their children safe at home may have moderate to high needs that don't require child welfare intervention, but may require some assistance from the community in helping them meet their needs. And that there's a comprehensive child safety assessment done no matter how, which track the family served on.
Can I interrupt for a moment?
Yes.
What happens when you have a conflict between what child services feel that there is a safety issue and the parents don't feel there is a safety issue? Because I'm looking further into some stuff that the federal government has nationally on this whole thing and the right for the parents to refuse. So I'm just curious where you're at when conflict occurs.
Well, as I've said, we're going to be doing a comprehensive CPS assessment, and part of the Oregon Safety Model is a family engagement model. We are engaging families through the whole process. It doesn't necessarily mean that we might agree on the decision at the end, but the idea is that child welfare is still responsible for ensuring the safety of that child, and if we need to take intervention to do that, whether that's going to court or putting a safety plan in place, we'll need to take the responsibility to do that.
Yeah.
The voluntary part is really if we find that the child is safe but the family has some needs, then it's up to the families if they want to be able to access services to address the needs that have been identified.
Thank you.
You bet.
What do you want to go to?
The next one. Okay, so I've already talked a little bit about the similarities of the two tracks, and I just want to talk a little bit about the differences, and I'm not going to go through them all. You can see them here, but I think this is a really nice way to show the differences. So we're really going to be focusing on neglect in the alternative track and the more serious physical abuse and sexual abuse cases on the traditional track. And that we'll be having a disposition on the traditional track, but not on the alternative track. Disposition doesn't equal safety, so we're really just focusing on addressing the needs of the family on both tracks, actually. So there's just one very quick example I'd like to give about how engagement might look different. So we're engaging families in both tracks. So on the traditional track, more families might experience an unannounced visit from a child protective services worker at the beginning of their CPS assessment. In the alternative track, they will more often get a phone call first and be able to have a little bit of preparation, so maybe some of the defenses and some of the fear might be able to be allayed before the CPS worker and the provider get out there. So we plan to start serving families in May of 2014 through this differential response approach. And we have chosen the first two counties, which are Lane and Klamath, to start in. And I just want to mention a staged implementation is really different than a pilot. So we're not piloting in Lane and Klamath to see if this works or not. We're really hoping to learn from the early counties, much like we did with the Senate Bill 964 process, learn and improve the process as we go. And so the idea is to have differential response, a statewide way of doing business with starting small. So we plan to start in May of 2014, and we've been in the process of implementation for some time. And just if you take a look at that graphic with all the teams involved, I just want to mention those teams are made up of staff and stakeholders from across the state, and I really think that that's our best way of building a really strong model that everybody can feel good about.
Thank you, Stacy. Any quick questions? Thank you so much. Of 13 years I've been sitting, not in this desk, but in this committee, child welfare has been one of the big issues that we've been working with all these years, and child safety especially. And it's exciting to see how this has been happening through the last couple of years. Very exciting. And we'll be wanting to hear from you again next year about how things are going. Certainly after May, we'll be having another hearing here to see how it's happening in Lane County and Klamath County. So thanks for your work. It's hard work, not just physically, but mentally, trying to come up with ways. When you have a big responsibility to keep our kids safe, a lot of kids in our state, and help families keep their children safe. It's a big responsibility.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. We appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we will move on to Community Mental Health Housing Fund. We have Chris Bonif, Ken McChesney, and Pam Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Chris Bonif, here representing the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, a grassroots membership organization with 13 chapters across the state. And I'll try to be as brief as possible and get you back on time. We'll discuss a little bit of history today and then kind of pivot to present day, where we have some exciting discussions going on with addictions and mental health, about some of the new investments in our mental health system, particularly coming out of the special session of the legislature. For history, the Community Mental Health Housing Trust Fund essentially was born out of the closure of the Damish State Hospital in Wilsonville in 1995, after some debate as to what was the fate of that property. Once Damish was closed, it was determined to sell the property for private development. A number of enterprising NAMI members and legislators from Clackamas County and others saw an opportunity to take what was formerly a site for institutionalizing people with mental illness and use the proceeds from the sale to invest in community housing across our state. They also set aside a portion of the property itself for integrated mental health housing, and that's a housing project now called Villa Bois, where you have a very successful model where people, adults particularly with living with mental illness, are integrated in a traditional neighborhood very successfully. The proceeds from the sale of property were then deposited into a trust fund that was created, the interest of which was to be spent on community mental health housing primarily, with a small portion to be spent on improving some of our institutions, institutional settings across the state. During more prosperous times, when financing was there was more liquidity in the market and financing was easier to build housing projects, the fund was very successful in providing some seed money that helped build housing across the state. To date, in the community, the fund has doled out about $2.9 million in interest. The economy then went into the tank, construction halted, the fund wasn't so successful, but the legislature, we would think in its wisdom, during lean years, didn't sweep money out of the trust, recognizing that it was really Oregon's only consistent source of revenue for housing for people with mental illness. That changed in 2012, where for various reasons the legislature took half of the principal of the fund, approximately $5.8 million. So today the fund is approximately, $5.8 million, generating, about $33,000 in interest a year, which isn't a very significant sum, certainly not large enough to seed any project large enough to really make a difference in our system. Okay, so that's the history of the Housing Trust Fund. at the time that it swept those funds, there was a kind of this loose promise to put funding back. It's still in the back of our minds as an advocacy organization. I mean, there's a lot of passion for us around that trust fund. It was a historic achievement, and one of the, you know, I think we are, based on kind of loose research, we're the only state that has that. Nevertheless, the legislature, in its wisdom, I think, in the regular session, made significant investments in our children's mental health care system, made some pretty solid investments in our adult mental health care system, made some minor investments in housing, but certainly not enough to really make a huge difference in our system. Coming out of the special session, we had the adoption of a cigarette tax for which the proceeds would benefit our mental health system, and in this biennium, that was expected to produce about $10 million. You know, it's no surprise that housing remains one of our top priorities. It remains one of the top priorities in the system itself. Everything we're doing, particularly for people with mental illness, is going to be predicated on housing. So in our healthcare transformation, certainly, you know, our population that we represent, people with mental illness, particularly serious mental illness, we cost the system a lot of money. And as you look across the coordinated care organizations, they're focusing on our population. And you can't treat us if you can't house us. And we don't have housing. And certainly, you know, overlaying all this, not to be forgotten, is that the U.S. Department of Justice is still coming into our state and wanting improvement for adults with serious mental illness. We're about to enter the second year of a four-year agreement that the state of Oregon entered in with the federal government about making sure that people, adults particularly with serious mental illness, live in more integrated settings and receive the services they need to keep them out of institutions. So with all that, it's not surprising that a lot of us are still talking about housing. And when the cigarette tax was approved, we were pleased that the Addictions and Mental Health Division, us and other stakeholders that we work with on various concepts around housing, really started, we came to agreement that additional $10 million should go towards housing. And we've been in discussions that Pam Martin can, with Addictions and Mental Health, can talk a little more about. Using that money, half of that money, for a concept that we introduced in the 2013 legislature, that you'll see summarized in your packet, about a housing incentive fund that leverages state spending to bring in outside financing to see that housing projects come to fruition around the state. And then the other portion, hopefully going towards more immediate needs. So the housing incentive fund is designed to build longer-term permanent infrastructure in our state, where then the additional funds would be used for more immediate needs to get people housing, so rental subsidies and vouchers and the type of things that help individuals with mental illness find affordable places and integrated places to live. And we're very pleased that to be having these discussions. It's a very exciting time. The legislature has made some wonderful investments in our system, and I think that we have a great opportunity right now to innovate and to complement many of the transformational things going on in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Pam Martin. I'm the Director of Addictions and Mental Health. And as Chris said, we have been having some very productive conversations with NAMI. We all have the same goal, which is to get people with mental illness into good, stable, safe, affordable housing. I think NAMI has a very good idea around building public-private partnerships with a portion of this funding. And they also acknowledge that we need another portion of this funding to get people immediately into housing. If we were able to go forward with this, I think we would have a good and long-term project around this, and I would look forward to continuing the work that we've started with NAMI.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Kevin McChesney, and I represent the Oregon Residential Providers Association, or ORPA as it's known as, and we represent the majority of the residential mental health providers in the state of Oregon. And we have been involved in planning for both the House bill in the last legislative session and with NAMI around this issue. And we're very supportive of the concept of really leveraging public dollars with private dollars and making those dollars go further and provide more housing. So there are many successful examples of this happening, both with for-profit developers and also not-for-profit housing agencies. And we also have been collaborating with AMH, and ORPA is interested in helping to sponsor or facilitate some sort of work session in the month of January to start to talk to bring in experts in the field and to really educate both providers and AMH staff on how these public-private partnerships would work.
In today's paper, I think it was, I was reading how cold it was last night and tonight and tomorrow night, and it talked about housing available, I think 30 beds in Clackamas County, and I live in Clackamas County. And it just occurred to me how the paucity of the number of beds. People are living outside under bridges, etc., and we provide so little coverage, so little housing for them, beds for them, all year long, but especially in days like this that we certainly are aware of that. And this is an issue we've been talking about for years and years, especially as we talk about the state hospital. We know it costs $250,000 a year to keep people in the state hospital. It costs a fraction of that to put them in the community. And we're just not meeting that need. And I don't know how we light a fire under ourselves and in the community to start this process. There is no excuse for this. The excuse, I guess, is money. But this is just totally unacceptable. And it's not cost efficient. If the only housing we're having for people who are mentally ill is in the state hospital, that's our fallback position. Mm-hmm. How short-sighted is that?
Or under bridges and then emergency rooms.
Yes, and in emergency rooms, yeah. People are dying out there. And I know you're all aware of this. And here in this dais, I think we're all aware of it. I don't know what it is that we do. We keep bringing this bill. What is it that we do that's going to be providing housing for this needy people who are mentally ill, no fault of their own? When somebody has diabetes or cancer, we know it's not any fault of their own. Maybe if you've got lung cancer and you're a smoker, but for mentally ill people, this is something they can't, they're not in control of. There are things that can be done to help them, but it's our responsibility. So if anybody has any bright ideas on how we can light a fire in this building to get help for these folks, I wish we would hear that. We hear testimony, and we want to hear that. We know we need to get the private community involved. We know we need more money. Yes,
a comment and a question. Bright idea. I think the increase in cigarette tax was a great start.
Yes.
Could go a lot higher than that. That would be
yes.
One, dedicated funding. But on that note, is there a decision on how to use that dedicated stream for mental health from the cigarette tax? You said you, in your collaboration, had come up with consensus that it should go toward housing. But where is it in the process? Has that been decided anywhere?
I'll defer to the state of Oregon on that question, Representative.
Thank you.
Chair Tomer, members of the committee and representative. I think there's general consensus that the Oregon Health Authority and within the addictions and mental health that this would be a very good use of $10 million, that we really couldn't be putting it in a better place. We're looking for support to use the money in that way and also to create this partnership with NAMI and other community partners. And we also hope that it's just the beginning.
So can I follow up, please? Thank you. Who makes that final decision?
I would imagine that it would be the leadership of the Oregon Health Authority along with committees such as this, which is why we're bringing this to you at this time.
Chair Tomei, if I may, what we hope, I think we can all acknowledge that things are underfunded, but we have an opportunity here. I mean, a lot of people are, we're one of the organizations that has benefited from a grant. We are enrolling our population in, you know, under the Cover Oregon. I mean, we're filling out paper applications as quickly as we can. We're going to have people who otherwise wouldn't be eligible for services have services, and if they have housing, I think we're going to, you know, that will be, if we can wrap services around people, if somebody has stability, we're going to do a better job.
Mm-hmm.
But our hope is that by creating this incentive fund and working in partnership with others and really bringing people to the table, affordable housing, those of us, we've never talked to affordable housing folks. For the first time we are, thanks to this concept, that we hope that we demonstrate success enough that this is something that perpetuates itself so that in any given year the legislature can make another investment into this type of fund that would lead to more permanent infrastructure. So it is as dire as it sometimes it is for somebody like me that's been doing this for a long time. It's an amazingly hopeful time.
Good, I'm glad to hear that. And keep on poking us in the back as the months go by and the years go by. We need more attention to this. We need more attention to this. Any other questions or comments?
I've got one.
Pardon?
I've got one.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our chair is very articulate about the urgency of the need, and you have a great and laudable goal. I'm going to have to probably disagree with my colleague on the other end there. I don't think this is a good beginning. I voted for it. But, you know, my simple question would be, and maybe I'm sure you can't answer it, is how many of our folks suffering from mental illness are smokers? How long can we depend on smoking to get a very laudable goal, you know, housing for these folks? We need them to keep smoking long enough to get this thing funded. And I don't like it as a beginning at all.
Representative, our population uses tobacco products at a disproportionate rate. There is a certain irony that one of the things that is contributing to the people we represent dying 25 years earlier than the general population is what is, you know, we're basically paying for that. I don't know how to answer it other than we've got money, and when you're sort of desperate for money, you have also the goal that the higher you raise a product, the less likely someone is to consume that product. You feel that there's a balance there somehow that allows you to do good things. How long, I would leave it to others who are economists who might know how long you can rely on a source for a product that you hope your population stops consuming.
Thank you all very much for coming. Good luck in the new programs. Now we hear from Margaret Van Fleet about Oregon Housing and Community Services. Update on the reorganization. Nice to see you again, Margaret.
Nice to see you.
And I think you've given, I don't know why this is black. Is there a meaning to this?
There is no meaning to the color of the folder, except what we had in the storage locker.
Nobody else wanted to use it, Margaret.
Apparently. Shall I begin?
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm very glad to be here today. The agenda you have certainly resonates for me, especially at this moment as we're thinking deeply about the state's role in the provision of affordable and supportive housing and how to improve service delivery to drive better outcomes for vulnerable Oregonians. You have a large black packet in front of you, and I will not go through the details of that, except that I do want to say those are the materials that are a work product that we've been generating over the last many months. And I'm going to give you a high-level overview via the PowerPoint this morning. And I'm happy to sit down with any of you and go through any of the details as that's of interest to you. So I wanted to make sure you had all of the materials that are out in the public sphere and that our partners are diving into, but I won't go through all that detail this morning. What I can report to you today is that the transition planning effort is very much on track. I feel like it has been a good, robust process, not perfect, but I feel like folks are engaged and making a positive contribution to the big questions that we're putting out in the world of affordable housing providers. There is some consensus beginning to emerge, and I'll get to that in just a minute. So I won't spend a lot of time reminding you, but just other than to say we have been at this for close to a year now. We set out after the governor issued his balanced budget last December, and I think you'll recall the kind of rigor we tried to put around this process over the past several months and the different pieces of work. And we are, as I say, still on track to complete and for me to make recommendations to the governor next month. One of the things I wanted to underscore, and I keep coming back to this in conversations with partners and employees, is that we started out by articulating some guiding principles and what do we want the future state to look like for affordable housing in the state of Oregon, so that we would come back again and again to those kind of core principles and what do we want to achieve, so that it's not simply a matter of rearranging boxes on an org chart or saving money. Those things may matter too, but really this has been very useful to continue to come back and remind folks and remind ourselves, what are we doing this for? What are sort of core principles around it? That has served us, I think, very well. The products of the work to date fall into kind of three categories, and I'm going to give you a quick overview of each of those categories. And on the one hand, we have scenarios for alternative service delivery model across six programmatic areas. And in some cases, in a programmatic area, that's a choice. You could change the service delivery this way or that way. You wouldn't choose both. You would make a choice. Or you would keep it the same. I suppose that would be a choice. In other cases, it's a service delivery model change that would just be the alternative to how it's done today. And I'll show you a little bit of a sample of what that looks like. But those are scenarios in the vernacular we've been using. We also came up with a lot of kind of smaller level things that in this context are called program elements. Those are not a service delivery model change per se, but they're good streamlining ideas, good ways of sort of making the work more simple for us and for our partners that may save money and drive better results. And so I'm going to show you a couple of samples of that. The most kind of interesting part, some would argue, me included, is sort of these big strategic policy questions that have emerged out of the work over the last several months. And I want to spend a couple of minutes in particular talking about those with you and seeing if you have any initial reactions today. So again, just a quick view of scenarios and a reminder that this is where there's a suggestion for an alternate way to do the service delivery. The other thing I would say is these aren't a final product. This is not, this is not the end product. This is a tool in service of a big conversation that we're having about how things are working today.
Here's the six areas across which we have teams have developed scenarios. And a word about the teams. We constructed these teams, scenario building teams, and armed them with as much data as we could find. We don't have perfect data, but as much as we could about how the program currently works, what's the statutory underpinning, what are the federal rules, how much money is it, how does the money work, as much as we could find out about those programs. In all cases, I had one or two subject matter experts from inside my shop, one or two from another agency in state government, and one or two or three from a partner agency. So these were well-rounded teams with a specific task to look at that data and come up with alternatives. So in the multifamily area, you can see we had two scenarios. This is not an either-or. Turns out we operate something that's called the Vertical Housing Tax Credit. It's not actually a tax credit, so nobody's quite sure why it got that name. It's a property tax exemption that's designed to promote density. It isn't a particular affordable housing tool, but it rests in my department. And so the team suggests you ought to think about seeing if revenue department wants that. Now, sidebar there is I've already talked to the director of the revenue department, and we're thinking about a couple of alternatives. But that's just a sample of one that came out of the multifamily area. Another suggestion that came out of the multifamily finance area has to do with how we might combine programs that have come out of very kind of diffuse moments in time and buckets of money and make it simpler for folks on the ground to use those resources. We had robust conversations about how we might change the streams of money that come through my agency that do energy bill payment assistance and weatherization work for low-income households. In that case, there is an either-or choice involved, and the utilities, the two big utilities, have been deeply involved in those conversations as well. People in our world, our partners in particular, like the streamlining we have begun in some parts of asset management. They want us to continue doing that. There was a strong call for expanding sort of flexibility and accessibility in the streams of money that we use with our partners to prevent and end homelessness. As you well know, we do lots of things in the housing counseling arena. Some is pre-purchase kinds of counseling and education, and other is foreclosure mitigation. So people had suggestions about how to do that differently. And then you'll recall that we operate a couple of different food-related programs. And so folks, in effect, suggested that this agency not do that work any longer. So we're having conversations about all of that. I won't get into the details of that. There's too much to see on the screen. You have these in the packet. The way it's constructed is you can see a kind of a graphic representation of the model as it is today, what the proposal for change is, and how would the change match up to those decision criteria that we set out. And so in each case of the scenario, again, they're in your packet, you can begin to see how the team did their analysis and what led them to the recommendation that they did, that they made. I don't want to dwell on that because the font is little and it will. That second big category of work, again, was program elements. Here's just a quick view in the multifamily finance area, which is the single biggest area of operations for our shop. Lots of suggestions for what I would call kind of streamlining and simplifying, which is, of course, an improvement to service delivery. And I won't spend time on the specifics of that. Again, it's all in your packet. The strategic policy questions, I think, are probably the biggest piece where you may have some thoughts, and so I want to take a couple of minutes on those. We didn't ask the teams to come up with them, but when they were doing the work, in several places they came back up with a big question that wasn't really about service delivery per se, but was kind of at that higher strategic level. And those questions are here, and there's a little bit more explanation of those as well in your packet. The first one is kind of the role and the placement of housing-related work inside state government. And it turns out many of our peers have their housing finance functions operated in an independent or semi-independent agency and not inside the executive branch proper. And so several partners have looked at that and said, you know, we ought to do that in Oregon. They can look at Washington and Idaho and some of our other peer states and say, we think they've got that figured out, and you, Margaret, and governor and legislature should consider the merits of an independent sort of a structure. So we're having, I would say, pretty good debates about kind of the pros and cons of that. And I'm kind of leaving open the kind of the conversation, if you will, and I don't want to wrap that up prematurely. But that's a really big one that gets to kind of structure. I am struck by the agenda you've got in front of you today and the consistent theme about the importance of housing. And I think I think one of the things we'd want to consider is if the housing functions, or some of the ones at least that I operate, take a step outside of state government, does that help us integrate, or does it not? Does it give us more flexibility that we can do more entrepreneurial things, and what are those trade-offs? And so I think that's a big question, certainly, if any of you have any thoughts about it.
Who will make that decision, Margaret?
Well, I think elected officials, both the governor and the legislature, ultimately will have to make that decision. I'll make a set of recommendations on all of this next month. And I'm taking in all of the input, and we'll synthesize and put my best foot forward, if you will, and then it'll be up for public debate, and I think the governor will either give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and then it'll come to this body.
Great, thank you.
The second big question has to do with the role that we might want to have a state agency, independent or not, play, particularly in the homeownership finance arena. The very beginnings of the housing agency in Oregon were around providing a first-time home buyer mortgage product. Been doing that since the 70s. We get authority from the feds to issue tax-exempt bonds to do that. And it's actually been the source of a lot of unrestricted revenue for us. So it's been a nice way that we've helped to pay for our operations and subsidize some particular programs over the years. But as you know, the housing market has gone through pretty significant change. Federal policy is being debated. What about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? What's going to happen to FHA insurance? Big questions about government's role generally in mortgage finance. We're not going to be able to settle those. But underneath that comes a question about, well, how aggressive should we be in Oregon? Where are the gaps that the banks and the private mortgage providers aren't meeting? And what role should we play in that arena? And how entrepreneurial might we want to be? So there's, another set of kind of complicated big questions inside of that, and some of the partners are debating that as well. And then the third one is one that we've talked about in this this committee in particular has talked about, and how do we set policy? And there is policy set all over the place in state government with regards to housing, and you've heard some of it, just in the presentations this morning, and more will come this after when I'm finished here. We don't have a single cohesive policy for housing and affordable housing and supportive housing in the state. We have individual policies that guide particular resources. And so there's a strong call, and I think this is a place where there's probably as much consensus as anything coming out of my conversations with partners about we really need a cohesive housing policy body, and that ought to be tied to how decisions get made and how governance and accountability are organized. So you'll see some recommendations from me about that as well, how to get it more focused in the kind of coming years. That's not something you do overnight, but I think there's a lot of room for improvement and consensus around this. So
So what's happening now is these questions, the scenarios, all this stuff was published the first part of this month. We had a big workshop that was co-sponsored with the Oregon Opportunity Network last week. I'm meeting with lots and lots of stakeholder groups, had some structured focus group time with our employees. So I'm spending really the month of November doing a lot of listening and debating and thinking, and then I'll wrap that up so that I can make recommendations to the governor next month. And again, I feel really good about the process. It's not perfect. We don't have perfect data, and there will be perhaps sort of differences of opinion, and people may want to debate the things I put forward next month, and I think that's all good. I feel like people have had an opportunity to input, and I've really benefited from that in this process. So that, that's what's coming up in the next month. That concludes my high-level flyby overview. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. A lot of great work. You've mentioned before you have 9 advisory boards, and you're trying to figure out how to streamline all of this. Mm-hmm. I know that's something that you're going to be presenting to the governor, and then yay or nay, we'll be hearing it. But are you starting to see a certain pattern emerge? Do you have any ideas about that?
Yeah, Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, very much so. I think, you know, each of the advisory bodies that are connected to my agency's work, they all have a particular value. They have expertise. They can guide program investments, for example, around how we do energy modernization or how we ought to be thinking about best practices with farm worker housing. Mm-hmm. Right? So they all have a particular value. And so one of the things I'm hearing strongly is if you're going to transition away from those, maybe they continue to have some kind of a technical assistance or a work group focus or a special sort of, subject area focus, but it all has to connect back to a bigger housing policy, mm-hmm. and that in turn probably needs to connect to what else are we doing to alleviate poverty in Oregon, right? And so these questions of health and child welfare and mental health and all of those things, even if I get a cohesive housing policy commission or cabinet or something, it leaves open the question, how do we make sure that we're not perpetuating a silo and not paying attention to the other systems? So there's a little, I have some thinking about that. I need to kind of settle down all the chatter.
Yeah.
But I think there will be good consensus about that.
Can I have a follow-up? Thank you for referring to people in poverty. And I'm wondering in what ways you're connecting to the Prosperity Initiative, mm-hmm. and also community action agencies. I know you're getting a lot of feedback,
yep.
but
yep.
kind of where is that leading you?
You bet. Chair Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer. I think in terms of the overall Prosperity Initiative, I'm pretty involved. We have a staff member who is helping to staff the First Lady and her work. And so I have just sort of a real-time sort of connection to what's happening there, which is very helpful. And I think the place where it's my understanding that the kind of plan for prosperity will go next is it will be much more connected to what we've called the 10-year plan and how agencies are going to be asked to do budgeting. And so there will be a much stronger emphasis on how do our individual agency budgets contribute to the long-term vision for Oregonians, mm-hmm. including, a prosperity lens. Mm-hmm. So, it's a little early to know very much more about that, but I think that's the place where things we set in motion, you kind of institutionalize them, if you will, when you do your budgets. And so that's the part of the way I'm thinking about that. Community Action Partners have been fantastic. I've spent a lot of time with their executive board and with the whole board. They were deeply engaged, for example, in a lot of the work both around energy and weatherization scenarios, mm-hmm. and around ending homelessness scenarios. They're the front lines for us in all of that work. And so so they've been great partners.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. Yeah, I know that you brought up budgets. What are you, I'm looking for sort of the direction in terms of governance and what that might mean to the legislature in terms of general fund allocations and authority. And so where is that?
Yeah.
Where do you see that going, I guess?
Yeah, Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, I think as it is, we get very little general fund into my agency. We get a little bit for some of the homeless programs, the SHAP, State Homeless Assistance Program, and the Emergency Housing Account, and then the food program, the general fund contribution to what effectively is the Oregon Food Bank flows through my agency. Otherwise, we don't currently get general fund for other programs broadly. And I think the mandate that, as I heard it from the governor and from the legislature, was come back with a balanced budget, not asking for, I'll balance it if you can give me more general fund. And so that's the way I'm proceeding. I do continue to project a budget gap in the way we've organized and kind of the business model, if you will, of roughly $8 million in the 15-17 biennium. Now, there's a lot of variables inside of that that have to do with the housing finance markets and bonds and so forth. So I'll keep an eye on that number. But in and amongst all of this, I've got a streamline because I have a gap, and my marching orders are to come back with a balanced budget. Now, if you know legislators, elected officials generally want to put more money into it, I'm never going to argue about that. But it's not my job to sort of ask for that, if you will.
Okay. Follow up, please. So, in terms of the scenarios, then, I mean, can we anticipate, will there be more scenarios, or are you going to be selecting from these, and how's that?
Yeah, thank you. Great question, Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos. I think I will choose from these. I may sort of, based on the good dialogue, some people are saying, the team kind of missed something, for example, or we don't think they went far enough. So I'm getting all of that feedback. So I may well put recommendations forward that are a modification of what's in here, but I'm not actively seeking people to come up with still more scenarios, if that makes sense.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Margaret.
Thank you.
The spaghetti is sort of clearing out a little bit.
A little bit.
Thank you. Now we're going to hear about farm worker housing. We have Gracie Garcia.
They've got here yet, so maybe we can put that back next week.
So do we have people here? I see Martha is here. Low-income housing for seniors and folks with disabilities. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
It's always good to see you.
Good morning. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit provider of affordable housing in Oregon. Our headquarters are in Milwaukee, in the Chairs District, but we have housing in 17 Oregon counties at this point. With me today, I have residents at two of our properties, John Woods and Randy Peasley, and I'll have them speak in a little bit. But first, I thought I'd provide a little bit of framing about housing for people with disabilities and people who are seniors. In the affordable housing world, one of the priorities is to meet the needs of people with special needs, including seniors and people with disabilities. It is an area that my agency has been actively involved in developing. We have over 400 units in our portfolio that are specifically targeted to people with disabilities, and we have over 600 units that are specifically targeted to seniors. So we have a lot of experience with this kind of housing. I think the first thing I'll do is just tell you a little bit about the profile of the folks that we serve. So the average income we have for folks with disabilities is about $8,000 a year. The average income of the seniors that live in our properties is about $12,000 a year. The average rent in Oregon for a one-bedroom unit varies a little bit from county to county.
Martha, could you lean up? There you go. Perfect. Thank you.
It's different mics, you know.
I know.
I did this yesterday, too.
Yeah.
So for a one-bedroom apartment in the metro area, the average one-bedroom apartment, including its utility costs, is about $775 a month. In Salem, that number is about $575 a month. But when you compare that cost to the incomes that we're seeing in our tenant populations, you can see that there's an enormous gap. We know that there are tens of thousands of households who have low incomes, who are unable to pay market rents. In Oregon Housing and Community Services data, they estimate that we have met about 11% of the affordable housing needs for seniors in the state. In terms of people with disabilities, they estimate that we have met about 20% of the need for people with physical disabilities, only 1.5% of the need for people in recovery from addictions, just a little more than 2% of the need for people in recovery from mental illness, and about 9% of the need of people who are developmentally disabled. So you can see there's an awful long way to go in terms of addressing the housing needs just for these two populations, seniors and people with disabilities. The housing model that we have is to blend and layer a variety of funding sources together. We bring together federal grants and tax credits, which are generally the biggest chunk of financing that comes into these properties. We have local government contributions, sometimes from the local government itself in their general fund or with surplus property or with property tax exemptions, and sometimes with federal funds that flow through local governments. And then we look at state governments. The state government is primarily a gap funding source, and that means once I've got the equity pieces put together with through grants and tax credits, once I have the debt pieces together, which may come from a private lender, perhaps with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, that, then I'm looking for the final gap pieces that come from the state. And those come from the document recording fee, that come from the Housing Trust Fund, that come from some weatherization funds. And that all together provides the affordable housing. So that's a little bit of the framework of how we finance affordable housing for this population and who lives in affordable housing for this population. With that, I want to introduce a couple of residents at our properties and have them tell you a little bit about their experience.
Martha, I'm going to see if there are any questions first before we move on. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. One question in the last statement that you made, what's the range of percent that that state fills in as the gap at the end?
It varies a little bit in terms of whether there's Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, but probably somewhere in the 5 to 10%.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
So let me ask John Woods, who is a resident at our property, The Oak, in downtown Portland, to speak.
Good morning. Representative Torme, Chairman, Resident Torme. I just want to tell you that I live downtown Portland at the Oaks. We have about 90 units, a lot of them seniors, a lot of disabilities. Then I want to give you a little bit about my background. I was a creative director for what's called industrial theater, and I've been making pretty good money, but ultimately it fell apart because I found out I had Parkinson's, and I had no place to go. Thanks to Martha and her organization, I got housing at The Oak, which I'm very grateful for. What was perfect for me is not only did I have good housing, but they helped me with my health care. They helped me. I was told that I would have to wait a year for a neurologist. Thanks to Northwest Housing Alliance, I saw one in 6 months. And the other part of that is, do you know what the donut hole is? That's where I'm at. My insurance fell apart in November, so I have no insurance for medication. Well, our resident services coordinator found some insurance for me that pays for my medication for 2 months to get me into next year. I don't know what else to tell you except thank you very much for what you're doing. I really appreciate your time. And do you have any questions?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
How much rent do you pay?
I pay $444 a month.
And how doable is that for you?
To have a place to live, it's doable.
You make it work.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Woods.
Thank you.
We really appreciate coming and hearing your story.
Oh, and I also have one more thing. I'm on the board.
Good.
I'm a resident on the board.
That's a big responsibility.
Yeah, it is.
It's time-consuming. Thank you for doing that.
Sure.
Thank you.
And then I want to introduce Randy Peasley, who is a resident at our village at the Headwaters property.
And where is that, Randy?
Hi, I'm Randy Peasley, and I do live at the village at the Headwaters Southwest Marigold in Portland.
Ah.
And first time I've done this.
No, that's okay. We all had a first time.
I like it very much because it's 55 and older. Unfortunately, I'm there. And I have disability with mental health issues. And I worked in office management until that got to my nerves. And so my home is, I have a one bedroom. And fortunately, in our building, we have a washer and dryer in each apartment. And I moved in there when it was brand new in 06. And I am very happy there. And I couldn't function otherwise if I didn't have that place to live in. And I volunteer for Loaves and Fishes at my church, Metropolitan Community Church, once a week to help the LGBT seniors get out of their houses where they can't be themselves still. And that's a wonderful, wonderful feeling I have with that. And guess that's about it. I'm very thankful to talk with you all today. This is amazing.
We're happy to have you. So how did you find this housing?
Northwest Pilot Project, which is just such a wonderful organization of very dedicated individuals with great love for everyone. And they have such limited resources, and for everyone they help is about 10 they can't help. But they put me in a lottery of Section 8 apartments, and I was one of them that got in. And like I say, I moved in when it was brand new, which was just so nice. And very, very happy there.
How did you find the that program? How did you know about that program?
One of the priests at the Episcopal Church told me about Northwest Pilot Project. And I guess, if I remember right, Northwest Pilot Project was started by the Episcopal Church years and years and years ago.
Been around a long, long time,
yes.
I know.
Right. Yeah, and they do such good. And but it just, as you said this morning, it bothers me on a day like today to think about people outdoors. And I can't conceive. I was homeless. I got to that point where the couches I served on were eliminated. And that's when all this took place. And I'm very, very blessed. But you know, through organizations like Martha and everybody that Northwest Pilot Project, they're just wonderful.
That's great.
Representative Gaya, go ahead.
I want to thank you, Mr. Wood, Mr. Peasley, Martha. I think you exemplify something that I think is really important that we think about when we think about housing. You know, I've said up here before that housing is much more than just the, you know, bedroom and a kitchen and et cetera. It's more than a housing. I mean, it's so you're on the board, you volunteer for Loaves and Fishes. I mean, that's the kind of civic engagement that happens, I think, when you have a secure place. Mm-hmm. And you can actually then, and also the fact that as seniors, you're former professionals and you're still giving to the community. So I really do want to celebrate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gallis.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Well, if Representative Kenny Geyer doesn't ask you, I will ask you. How much do you pay for that, Mr. Peasley? How much are you paying for that?
With the subsidy with the Section 8, I still pay $357, which it went up $40 last year. And it's going to go up again because they're running out of money.
Because they've what?
They're running out of money.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all about money.
A lot of it is, isn't it? And having the intention of finding the money so that we can provide the services.
And I spoke this morning with one of our tenants. She works with people with children and adults, and she refers a lot of people to the Northwest Pilot Project. And she said, Randy, I've got kids coming, and their tummies aren't full because the food stamps have been taken away.
Yeah.
This wasn't, when I was a kid, this world didn't exist like this.
I think if it did exist, we might not have been aware of it.
Now, at least in my neighborhood, it didn't exist at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Mr. Peasley, maybe I'll ask this of both of you. So John Mullen is here in the back, and he always talks with us about SSI and providing services for people, income for people, as they apply for Social Security benefits. And then very often they're turned down the first time, and the second or third time they're able to get it. So have either of you had that experience?
I had to. I had a lawyer. Not a great lawyer, shall we say. And I was turned down for my disability. And the second lawyer I was recommended to, and it was boom, boom, boom.
Right.
It was done.
Good. We're glad to
I never had SSI.
Okay.
And I didn't have any problems because I had seven doctors.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, yeah.
They just slide right through.
Yeah, good.
So I
think
for
some people it's more difficult, yeah. Okay, any other questions or statements? Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate hearing from you. Thank
you
for coming down today. So now I know we have some folks from Farmworker Housing. We have Gracie Garcia, right? And Deanna Starr? Am I pronouncing that correctly? Alejandro Ortega? Hi there. Glad you're here.
And you also have Peter Heenley from CASA, Oregon.
Great.
Sherwood, Oregon. I'm not here to testify. I'm going to translate today.
All right.
So Gracie can concentrate on her testimony. So.
Terrific. Well, glad you're here.
Go ahead,
Gracie.
Thank you
for coming.
I'm Gracie Garcia from Cornelius, Oregon. I work at Being a Star. I'm the program service director. Been there for a little bit over 8 years. Coming from a farm worker person, came from Texas when I was probably 6 years old, and I've been in the area in Cornelius for all that time. So, BNSI is a nonprofit organization that started in 1981. There was the need of having housing apartments for our farm worker families. Myself living in a camp for 3 years straight, I know how difficult it is when you have to move from one place to the next place to the next place. So it's really my heart, passion that I have the opportunity and push to work for BNSTAR. We understand, and as you said, Representative Gallego, was that it's not only a place to live, but we do resident services. Our mission is to help our families help themselves so that they can get better skills and move on to buying a home, a better employment, better jobs for themselves and their families, to try to get our kids into the education, into college, and move on. So that's really our mission for BNSTAR. We at this time have GED classes. We do ESL classes for adults and for kids. We also do homework club for our kids. Right now we have 96 kids that after school come and we help them with homework. We do computer classes. We do financial literacy classes. Tonight we're having education navigation workshop in trying to work with our kids, our teenage kids, trying to help them get into college, helping them with scholarships. With the help of GASA, we work with them so that we can get their IDA, individual development account, where they, our kids, are saving up money for college. So for every dollar they save, we give them $3. So if they save $1,000, we give them $3,000.
Where do you get that $1,000?
It's through GASA. Go ahead, if you want to.
Chair Tomei, the Individual Development Account program is a federal program supported by the state through a tax credit, and it will be coming up for renewal in a couple years.
Thank you. And that's been a great help. We also do home buying. So in the last 2 years, the last 3 years, we've had two of our families buy a home through the IDA program. I also do teach and certify for home buying classes counseling, so I teach the home buying classes. I think most than anything else, the importance of having services so that our families can get out of our nonprofit organization's affordable housing and into a better place or into a place of their own, and that's what we do in a little nutshell.
That's great.
I'd like to introduce Alejandro Ortega. He's a resident of ours, and so.
Buenos días a todos.
Good morning, everyone.
Gracias por escucharme.
Thank you for having me here.
Soy un residente que vive en los apartamentos de Montebello.
I'm a resident of Montebello Apartments.
Trabajo para Bienestar como promotor.
I work at, como voluntario.
Promotor.
Yes, as voluntario. A volunteer promoter at Bienestar.
And promoter, promotor, what we have is we have 12 promotores, and that's what it is peer leaders that live in our community, and they live in every one of our sites that we have, 11 sites, we have 12 promotores. So it's people that live there that are leaders, and they're the ones that do home visits within their own apartment sites.
Es una buena experiencia para mí vivir en esos complejos. Tengo 12 años viviendo ahí.
It's been a very good experience living in the apartments. I've been there for 12 years.
Tengo una linda familia.
I have a beautiful family.
Somos un número de 7 personas, mi esposa y 5 hijos que tenemos.
I have 5 kids and a wife.
La mayor de mis hijas está estudiando en el PCC de Rock Creek. Está estudiando de enfermera.
Most of my children are studying at PCC Rock Creek to be nurses.
Y de alguna forma se está beneficiando del servicio de IDA.
And we also benefited from the IDA program.
Para terminar sus estudios.
For them to help with their studies.
Tengo un hijo también que está terminando la high school. Está en la high school Liberty.
One is at Liberty High School.
Él también está en el programa de IDA.
Also in the IDA program.
Porque tenemos muchas ilusiones de que él termine sus estudios más adelante, su colegio.
Because they have
Isla Dreams,
thank you, to finish high school and go on to college.
Tengo tres hijas más, una que está en la Middle School en la Evergreen, en Hillsboro, eso está ubicado en Hillsboro. Otras dos hijas que están en la Lincoln Street, se llama Shirley, Ashley. Como verán,
yeah, so three other children that are studying, and ¿cuál edad es de estos tres?
13 años, 11 años y 8 años.
Of 8, 11, and 13 ages.
Tengo mucha gratitud por estar viviendo en estos complejos, porque me ha dado la oportunidad a mí como persona de desarrollarme.
It's been a great opportunity living here because it's also given me an opportunity to develop myself.
Me he beneficiado de los servicios que da Bienestar, por ejemplo, el GED.
For example, the GED classes.
Este año tuve la fortuna de terminar mi GED.
I finished my GED classes this year.
Y tengo esperanzas del próximo año. De hecho, tengo ya una fecha concertada para iniciar mis clases de inglés el día 6 de enero.
So next year he's looking forward to starting his English classes.
También he recibido clases de computación por parte de Bienestar.
Also received computer classes.
Un poco de clases de ESL.
A little bit of class of ESL, the second language.
Yeah. En cuanto a la experiencia que tengo ahí, me he beneficiado en el sentido de que trabajo de mi tiempo libre con Bienestar, dando información a los promotores, a los residentes, perdón.
And in the free time that he's had, he's been in this role as a promotor, he's been happy to be able to kind of give back.
Conociendo sus necesidades, ayudándoles en qué podemos hacer para ellos, cuáles son los servicios que más necesitan. Por ejemplo, hay muchas personas adultas que no saben leer.
So he's been in the position to find out what their needs are and be able to communicate those needs then back to the organization.
Y el 99% de los residentes que viven en el complejo donde yo vivo, trabajamos en el campo.
Are farm workers, so the requirements of this project are that everybody has to work in agriculture.
Actualmente estoy trabajando en una nursería que se llama Isragi Nursery, que está ubicada en Hillsboro.
So he works at a nursery, and I can't pronounce the name of it.
Isragi.
Thank you, Isragi. Okay.
Tengo 12 años. Para el próximo año cumplo los 12 años trabajando ahí.
He'll finish 12 years working there.
Mi trabajo actual ahorita es mecánico. Estoy dando servicio a las maquinarias.
I'm a mechanic there at the nursery.
Y el interés que tengo por aprender el idioma de inglés es porque quiero estudiar un curso de mecánica para poder obtener alguna licencia de mecánica.
And my interest, why I really want to learn English, is because I want to get my license in mechanic.
Could you ask and move a little bit away?
Oh, sorry. Eso me abrirá un poco de más oportunidades a mí como persona y en a mi familia.
This would open me the opportunity to, as a person and for my family.
Claro, el programa de bienestar, los programas que nos está dando a nosotros como residentes, nos ha beneficiado a muchos.
The programs that Bienestar has given us has really benefited us a lot.
Estoy muy contento de vivir ahí porque me ha dado la oportunidad.
I'm very happy to live there.
De no estarme moviendo constantemente como muchos compañeros de mi trabajo lo hacen.
Not having to move here and there like a lot of my coworkers do.
Es un gran beneficio tener una estabilidad.
It's a great benefit to be stable.
Donde mi familia la siento que está segura.
Where my family I feel is very secured.
Mis hijos tienen su estancia en la casa muy, muy feliz.
My kids are very happy at home.
Hemos tenido muchas experiencias muy bonitas el estar viviendo.
We have had a lot of good experience.
La gente que nos rodea, que nos ayuda, los managers, los coordinadores de los programas, nos dan esa herramienta para poder llevar la información hacia las familias, poder ayudarlas.
the manager, it's been very helpful. The managers, the coordinators that have helped us that live there in Bienestar and work in Bienestar have given us the tools to get ahead, to benefit us.
Es importante saber todos los beneficios que existen, que a veces muchas familias no tienen los conocimientos o no saben qué hacer cuando tienen algún problema.
It's very important that as promotor to go out and give out information that a lot of the residents might not know how to get the information. So it's very important for that.
Actualmente estoy trabajando también como miembro de la mesa directiva.
I'm also on the board of Bienestar.
Y eso también es importante para mí como persona saber.
As a person, it's very important to me.
Saber qué hacen con los fondos, qué tienen contemplado hacer para poder ayudar a más gente que trabaja en el campo.
Because it's very important to know where the funds are coming from, what's going on, so that I can help other people.
He tenido experiencia de trabajar en diferentes lugares del campo.
I've had experience in working in different work at farm workers.
Recogiendo fresas, blueberries.
Picking berries, blueberries.
Sacando de los files árboles tan bonitos que se miran en los malls, en las casas.
Pulling out the trees that you see that are very beautiful in the malls, in the houses.
Es un trabajo duro, pero muy bonito.
Hard work, but very beautiful.
Hay mucha gente, muchas familias que dependemos de esos ingresos, de esos trabajos para poder llevar una vida un poco mejor y poder darles a nuestros hijos lo más que podamos darles.
There's a lot, it's very important. There's a lot of people that depend on the kind of work that we do for the beneficial that we make money and that's how we support ourselves.
Es un trabajo que yo miro muchos compañeros sufren en estos climas.
I see a lot of coworkers suffer from the weather when they're working outside.
Pero es muy satisfactorio.
It's very satisfactory.
Hacer ese tipo de trabajos.
That kind of job.
Pero también nosotros nos corresponde como personas querer superarnos.
But like person, like people, we want to better ourselves.
Yo he tenido comentarios con mis compañeros de que debemos de prepararnos como personas porque tenemos que estar preparados qué va a pasar mañana.
I've talked to my coworkers and we've had talks about how important it is to better ourselves because we're looking for the future, for tomorrow.
Casey, one of the things I would like to know is what proportion of the workers who are working in the fields in the Cornelius Hillsborough area are able to live in this kind of housing?
We have 11 sites. Mm-hmm. It's right now it's close to 1,000 people that we have in our sites. It's the Lower Hillsborough, Forest Grove, Cornelius area. They're all farm workers except for three sites. Three of our sites are just working poor families. We do have one site over at Zacapuz, which is 24 apartments. It's pretty close to, as well, about 1,000 kids. The requirement on the eight apartments are that you have to be farm workers. The other three sites is you just have to be low income.
So what I'm wondering is what proportion of people are able to live in these homes that are pretty, it seems nice, as what proportion of the farm workers are living in these houses?
Chair Tomei, I'll attempt to answer that one.
Yes.
So when we develop affordable housing projects, we go through an analysis of need and demand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to guess in Washington County, the affordable housing that's available for the farm worker population probably serves about 6% of the total farm worker population. That includes their families. That's about what we would estimate.
Okay.
It would be different by different counties. So.
Yeah, right. Okay. Great. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Gallegos.
Señor Ortega, gracias por estar aquí y por su historia. You know, Gracie, I came here when I was 2 years old from Texas, too, so it's, yeah, you're right. You know, I just appreciate this presentation, again, because it just emphasizes really the task that we have in sort of reorganizing and not losing all of this good program that we have, and how do we sort of develop a new system in which then we can actually enhance those programs and so on. And this is such a great example, again, of the capacity building, of the empowerment of the community, of the civic engagement that Mr. Ortega is really, I mean, the outreach that he does, the community leadership that he does, I think is again an example of how this housing provides stability that allows us then to really enhance our communities with civic engagement and so on. And it also helps me to recognize the importance of stability and how important this low-income housing is in terms of perpetuating some kind of stability in our communities. So again, thank you. I guess to Peter, I'm curious, what does this mean for the legislature? What do we need to be thinking about here?
Representative Gallegos, Chair Tomei, you know, I've been before this committee a few times. I'm cautious of asking for anything more. I'm tending to focus on the transformation and kind of the really big picture and how government is going to serve the folks that really need to be served. So at this point, I'd like to give you an answer, but I think I'll wait for Margaret to put forth her proposition and then comment. I know that's kind of evasive, but you know, there are some of us that would like to see a independent commission, because I think where in the states where I have seen commissions operating, you see a longevity in the positions, you see a lot more innovation, you see a lot more nimbleness, you see a lot of different things. There's going to be people that either because there's vested interests or we want to make sure that the public purse is protected are not going to want to have that put somewhere else. So for me, I think that's the key. Well, excuse me, I'm going to say that's the second key question. The governance is really the key question. We need a policy-making body to really guide our efforts in affordable housing and related services and how we serve folks. That's what we need, and we don't have that right now.
Any other questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment to say thank you so much for being here, and my advice is I would pay your second translator.
thank you very much. Thank you all. Poor Peter.
Thanks so much for my second career.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Gracias. Gracias.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Next, we will hear about transitional housing for persons released from incarceration. So we have Rachel Post, Doug Bishop, Paul Solomon, and Paul Wells. Thank you all for coming today.
You want all four of us?
Sure. Come on down. Christy's going to help you here. We're so glad you came today. Thank you for coming. Do we need this anymore?
No.
Good. Let's pull it up and open the blinds. Let's see that sunshine out there. What's that? You have a hand up?
I'm sorry. I submitted it all.
Full viewing on the.
Sorry, were you going to show it on the here?
No.
Oh, good.
Hey, good morning, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Post. I'm the Public Policy Director for Central City Concern in Portland. Founded in 1979 as a 501c3, Central City Concern provides a continuum of affordable, supported housing options, including permanent supported housing. Today we're going to talk about transitional housing for people exiting incarceration. We provide affordable, supported housing options, patient-centered primary care, and employment services to an estimated 13,000 people each year who are exiting poverty and homelessness. Today I'm here to share with you the success we have in serving individuals exiting incarceration through Central City Concerns Alcohol and Drug-Free Community Transitional Housing Program, which is operated by our Recovery Peer Mentors and works in collaboration with our Supported Employment Center and our Outpatient Alcohol and Drug Treatment Programming. I'd like to just recognize very quickly in our audience David Fitzgerald, who is the supervisor of the Recovery Mentor Program. And
thank you for
today,
coming, David.
He and Doug Bishop, who will be speaking to you next, also brought some of the peer mentors who would otherwise be doing volunteer work in the community but came down today for this educational experience. So thank you, guys. Individuals are selected into this program. They're handpicked, actually, by our recovery peer mentors who are employed full-time and also have the life experience of having been people who experienced serious addictions and people who experienced incarceration. The recovery peer mentors are working with people daily on modifying their beliefs, behaviors, and taking personal responsibility and working a strong program of recovery. Our mentors all have, as I said, firsthand experience, and clients selected into the program remain housed in our alcohol and drug-free community housing, single-room occupancy units for up to 6 months while they work with their recovery peer mentors and employment specialists on securing permanent housing and employment. This program was designed over a decade ago by a man in recovery from heroin addiction who had a criminal history, and the Recovery Peer Mentor has succeeded in engaging hundreds of formerly incarcerated career addicts with no other where no other program has before. Its success has been made famous nationally in a 2007 award-winning documentary titled Finding Normal by Portland filmmaker Brian Lindstrom, and an independent evaluation by Portland State University found that individuals served through this kind of transitional housing showed a 95% reduction in drug use and a 93% reduction in crime 1 year after completion. Transitional supported housing is a cost-effective alternative to incarceration when paired with outpatient treatment and supported employment. It can significantly reduce recidivism for many individuals who are incarcerated for reasons related to their addiction disorders. Thank you for allowing me to share the success of this model today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Vice Chair and the rest of this committee. My name is Doug Bishop. I'm the recovery mentor at Central City Concerns. But before that, I am a recipient of transitional housing. You know, it's like you could say that, okay, you could look at my record and you wouldn't tell you the story. I recovered from drug addiction. I recovered from criminal activities. And I didn't have a chance. I was born into a life where my family were drug users, criminals, prostitutes, violence in my home. My family reunions were at Walla Walla State Penitentiary and McNeil Island Federal Institution. So, of course, at 9 years old, I started using, and at 11 years old, I started committing crimes. It was what I was brought up doing. It was what I was taught to do as a young child. Of course, I did have a choice after I became a young man, but the lifestyle took a hold of me, and I was caught, and I didn't know there was a way out. And so, you know, after about, I don't know, 22 and a half years of never having a job, fathering the child I abandoned, disowning my family, not thinking that there was anything left for me to do but to die in the streets or die in a penitentiary, looking for a way out but not knowing there was a way out, my mentor, who was David Fitzgerald, came into an institution. And he came with some other men, and that's when it sparked me and said, you know, I know these people. These people were just like me, and if they could do it, maybe I could do it, you know. And I was skeptical, and what I can say is that I'm grateful for the opportunity I was given, because today sitting here, and this is not the thing I wanted to do this morning. I did not want to wake up. I did not want to come down here, and I did not want to talk. But I have a passion and a belief that I have. It is my right and my obligation to let you know that we do recover and we do have value. I live in a nice home today. I have a wife that I've been faithful to and married to for 6 years. I take care of my mother. I also took care of my caregiver for her husband and my aunt in our home. My grandkids love me. They think I'm Santa. I think they figured out that there's no Santa. There's this grandpa because he brings all this stuff that they want and need. But I have value today. And what was instilled to me in transitional housing that this wasn't another place to be farmed out to and to be housed permanently and to be set on the shelf. This was a place where I was challenged daily because I came there with no work history. I never had a job before in my life. I didn't know how to do relationships with family members or anybody. You know, there's a couple of terms that psychiatric doctors have given me, and I could have bought into that, but I didn't. But because I do have value. But today is I'm able to sit here and have value, and I do have an impact on my community, and I am a good neighbor, and what was instilled in me is that I need to continue to raise the bar because I didn't think I could ever have a job or have value or work. I didn't know that I could go to a place and ask for help and say, hey, you know what, man, I don't know how to fill out an application. I never filled one out. I don't know my Social Security number. I never used it before. I was 38 years old. I don't know how to pay rent. So today, with the help of other men like David, that instilled in me that, you know what, it's okay if your life gets better, but then what? You need to have value in yourself and instill that value in other men. And we're here to help you. And if you don't understand, it's okay. You don't have to be scared. It's okay. We will help you. And what they did, they walked me through the process of filling that application. And for once in my life, being honest that, you know what, I know I don't have a job history. I know I have a criminal history. But if you give me the opportunity to work for you, I'll do a good job. And they gave me that chance. And there's a lot of stuff that went along with that that was confusing and it was overwhelming. But to have a place where I could go that was safe with like-minded people around me constantly, that could encourage me and uplift me, because what I can tell you is that everything I did since I got out of the penitentiary in, what was it, October 5th, 2006, has been new. Dating a girl was new. Driving a car, getting a license, having insurance, paying mortgages, paying taxes was new. I'd never done none of that stuff before in my life. And if I would have believed what they told me when I was sitting in that penitentiary, that the best they could do for me was put me on the shelf and dust me off every once in a while, I'd probably still be there. But men like David and other men that helped him instilled hope in me and said, you know what, you do have value. You're not a throwaway kid. We're here to help you, and if you allow us to, we will. And today, 7 years later, most of my financial debts are paid. It was hefty. I'm about $2,900. Been paying for 7 years, and my goal is to pay that off because that's the money I owe. But the bond with my wife, the bond with my family, my grandkids, the impact I have in my community, and you know what, I could tell you all the things I do personally in my personal life, but that's not why I do them. I do them because somebody did them for me. And so not only do I have the position I have as a result of the work I've done and the men that came before me to help me, I probably work with more men personally than I do professionally.
So when did you start this process? Was it in prison or after you got out?
So the first time I thought that I was like, okay, maybe I want to do something different. I was finishing a 5-year sentence, and I did no work prior to know what different meant. And what I can tell you is that when my family came and seen me and I did no work on myself to accept the feelings that came behind dealing with my family, is that I copped out and I left. 30 days later, I was back in prison. And I said, if I want some help, I might want to go to treatment. I went to Turning Point in Columbia River. David, Bobby Sassau, Randy Servisto came in and did a presentation. And there was a counselor there named Myron Jay, who I knew personally. And that's when I started fighting for my life.
How old were you?
I was 30 when I got out.
No, when you started the process.
Started the process of getting clean or to start a process? Well, I think I wanted to. I thought I could, probably about 35. I actually, at about 27, I realized that something must have been wrong with me, that I was okay with sitting in here letting people take care of me. And I did. I was like, this...
But why when you sought help with David, right?
Yeah.
David.
Let's see, so I'm 43. He came in. I can tell you the date. David came and got me October 5th, 2007, Columbia Correction Facility.
He came to get you?
Yep, he came and got me.
What do you mean, to get you?
I was being released October 5th, and he came and picked me up and took me to the mentor program.
But you had started the process of thinking when you were still incarcerated, right? It sounds like you made that decision somewhere when you were still incarcerated, right?
So that would be October 25th, 2006.
Good for you.
Is when I thought that maybe I might need to, if I could only last on the streets for 30 days without reoffending, without getting loaded, maybe, and I wanted to be clean, and I wanted to get a job, and I wanted to do all that stuff, but didn't know how, and I tried it on my own, and it didn't work, well, maybe I need to seek some help.
So then he came to meet with you. You met with him, right? And then after you got up, he helped you find this housing at... Central City Concern?
Yeah, he came and picked me up, and at that time, the mentor program moved a few times. It was at 8 Northwest 8,
uh-huh.
And the mentor office was across the street at the treatment center. He brought me there. he went and got me enrolled in treatment, got me a food box, got me hooked up with a couple guys to take me to a meeting, let me use the phone to call my family, and told me some simple things.
And you had housing at that point. He helped
yes,
you get
I did.
Housing, which is an important part of this,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Housing is the key.
Right.
You know, I needed a safe place to be.
Right.
And what I can tell you is that even though it was a safe place, it was pretty uncomfortable. It was the first time in my life since I was 3 years old remembering that when I went up to my room and shut the door, it was quiet. And it freaked me out. I had never been nowhere in my life where it was quiet, where it wasn't somebody getting beat up, wasn't no yelling, wasn't no keys rattling, wasn't no guns going off. I walked up there, I closed the door, and it was quiet, and it scared me.
You know, I could listen to you all day, but we have to move on because we've got another program. But thank you so much for coming and sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. My name is Paul Solomon. I'm the executive director at Sponsors in Eugene, where I've worked for the last 13 years. I've been involved in public safety issues for the last 20 years. I serve on the Governor's Reentry Council. I'm the vice chair of Lane County's Public Safety Coordinating Council. And I'm happy to say that this year, Sponsors is celebrating our 40th anniversary of providing reentry services in Lane County. We currently operate 11 buildings on 5 sites with 135 beds of transitional housing for people with criminal histories. Over the years, we've been able to develop a range of programs designed to, based on years of experience, research, and best practices in the field. We provide a variety of on-site programs built around our transitional housing, including a mentoring program, cognitive behavioral therapy, a one-stop reentry resource center, a veterans program, an education program, drug and alcohol treatment, and services for sex offenders, as well as targeted programs for women and children. And over the last 25 years, we've been able to incrementally increase our housing programs, yet we've not been able to meet the overwhelming demand of people releasing from prison. Our transitional beds are regularly booked out 6 to 10 months in advance. In 2010, we opened a new 72-bed facility that is seen as a model for transitional housing in Oregon. This $6 million project came about through a unique partnership with sponsors in Lane County's Housing and Community Services Agency. Using low-income housing tax credits, VA grant and per diem capital funding, and a mix of private foundation support and individual donations. Our transitional housing programs are designed to foster self-sufficiency. At the point a client completes the program, they will have found full-time employment and or schooling, passed all of their drug and alcohol screens, maintained compliance with the conditions of their release, and moved into permanent sustainable housing. One of the problems with our current funding model for reentry, or lack thereof, is that many people releasing from prison homeless may or may not have access to services based on where they are released. I get 40 to 50 letters a week from men and women in state prison. Approximately 20 to 25% of those letters are from inmates releasing to other counties, requesting housing at sponsors because of the lack of transitional housing in their respective counties. We need to look for ways to foster and start new programs. Nonprofits are uniquely positioned to provide these services, but require startup funding and support. As a result of House Bill 3194, the state is slated to flatline prison spending and increase its support for community corrections. For too many years, we have disproportionately invested in our state prison system at the expense of funding for reentry services and community corrections. We have a much better opportunity to provide meaningful interventions at the local level that will keep people out of prison with proper funding. These more effective and efficient local control options need to be made robust as a part of the reinvestment process in House Bill 3194. We need to make sure that funding is being used to increase the amount of transitional housing statewide, and it is being spent on interventions that will reduce our dependence on prison beds. Appropriate sites for new programs can also be a real challenge. We had over 30 years of experience when we sited our men's sex offender housing programs 10 years ago. Despite the fact that the property was zoned appropriately and not in the middle of a residential neighborhood, there was a fair amount of pushback in the community. Fortunately, we were able to mitigate the challenge by going door to door and talking to neighbors and going to neighborhood association meetings. And ultimately, we prevailed, and that program has operated in the community for the past 10 years without a single incident or problem. The other thing that we've done in recent years is really embrace the use of validated risk assessment tools to determine who gets into our programs. In a recent evaluation by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, Sponsors Reentry Resource Center was found to have reduced new criminal charges versus a control group by 31%. And a corollary cost-benefit analysis showed that for every dollar invested, there was $14 in future correctional costs that were saved, as well as victimization. This year, in closing, 4,500 people will release from state prison and return to our communities. I think the question we need to answer is, under what conditions will they return? Will they arrive at bus stations, homeless, indigent, and high risk to reoffend with nowhere to go? Or will we provide supportive housing and evidence-based interventions that will help them become self-sufficient, tax-paying, law-abiding members of our community? Thank you. And it's also my pleasure to introduce to you Paul Wells, who is one of the many people. We serve about 350 to 400 people a year in our transitional housing programs, who has graduated from our program in the last year or two. So with that, Mr. Wells.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Paul Wells.
You might want to scoot up just a little bit.
Not very much. No, okay. Not too much.
Okay.
Right.
And I served 20 years at OSP. In July of 2011, I was told that I was being released in December. And the first thought that came to my mind was terror, because I have no family, no friends, and nowhere to go, and no support system. I was in ill health, and I had lost my sight while I was in prison. And the thing that my counselor told me, said, there's a program in Eugene called Sponsors, and it's something I want you to investigate. Write a letter explaining your situation and just be honest and open about what's going on in your life. And I arrived at Sponsors on December 16th, 2011. I'll be out. I'll have my freedom for 2 years in a couple of weeks. And when I got the Sponsors, I found a sense of relief, because I found that there was someone here to give me guidance. There was a place that I could set my feet firmly on the path to developing a new life for myself. There was a program for me that was there to help me. And I went through the transition phase. I went through the honors phase. And now I'm out on my own. I have my own apartment. I go to the library. I just do simple things that bring me joy. And a simple fact, if not for sponsors, I would have come to Eugene on the Greyhound bus with $35 and nowhere to go. And that thought terrified me because after 20 years, I was tired. I did not want to come back to prison. I'm not going back to prison. And I've begun to build my life in a way that's comfortable and pleasing for me for the first time in a very, very long time. I have neighbors that know where I was because I never hid it from anyone. I didn't hide it from them. And they've accepted me and shown me a love that I haven't seen in a long, long time. And now I'm getting ready to become a mentor at sponsors. You know, with my limited vision, but still I feel an obligation and a commitment to do something positive to show that this program can and does give you a hand up. It's not a handout. You have to work for it. It gives you a hand up. And if you do what's necessary to do the program, because there's a responsibility and there's guidelines that you have to adhere to at sponsors. And if you follow those guidelines, the sky becomes blue again. That's the only thing I can say. The sky becomes blue again. I can't see very well, but I know there's a blue sky above me. I have my own little home. I'm content. I'm happy. And I'm safe. And that's the most amazing thing in the world to me, because I never thought I would be again, because I had spent the last 20 years in a closed, dark environment. And now there's light around me. And I am grateful that you allowed me to come speak to you. But even more so, I'm grateful to sponsors for what they did for me.
Thank you, Paul.
That's, yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Wonderful presentation. Any questions here? Representative Kenny Goddard.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering for both of you, what kind of ongoing support are you getting? You're getting housing assistance. And what other kinds of supports?
I go through the HACCSA program for my housing. I have a one-bedroom apartment, and I had some health issues over the last year, but I had started at Lane Community College, and now that my health is on the mend, I intend to go back to school, as I say, become a mentor, and there's a range of things that are there for you to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. The question is, do you want to take advantage of them? You have to be willing to take responsibility for who and what you were in the past and put your feet on a path that leads to a future.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So for me, no, I'm not on any type of assistance. Probably 90% of the men and women in our population will be fully self-supporting. Self-sufficient, that's where our key is. There will be some cases where they might need a little extra help, and we will help them with that. But me, no, I pay a mortgage, I pay taxes, and I'm fully self-supporting.
Thank you. So,
good question. Representative Andy Olson and I are both on the Judiciary Committee, and we hear a lot about incarceration and programs and people leaving. And we know that the recidivism rate is close to 30%. So could the two of you talk about the recidivism quickly, because we've got another program we need to talk about.
It's easy to fail, but if you work hard, there is no reason why you can't rebuild and restore your life in the community outside of prison. And that's been my goal since the day I set foot at sponsors.
That's great, Paul.
Representative Tomei, members of the committee, the one thing that I would mention about recidivism, because we get a lot of federal funding, we're required to slice and dice recidivism in every possible manner. And for most of our programs, the reduction in recidivism is around 50%. And that's measured against the DOC baseline, over 3 years. So our mentorship program, as well as a Second Chance Act funded program that we have both reduced recidivism by about 50%.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we have a few different programs. I should clarify that probably about 70% of the people that we serve through Central City Concern have histories of incarceration. For one Department of Justice grant that we participated in for 5 years, the recidivism over that period was 11%. We were one of the highest performing projects in the country. That's one small program that we operated. And then, as I mentioned, the study conducted by Portland State University, while it didn't look at recidivism, it did show that there was a reduction in criminal activity by 93% over a one-year period. I can get you more information that specific by programs. I know we also have a Department of Community Justice, some funding for transition service unit beds, but those are only 30 days, so we don't actually track recidivism for that very different program than what we described today.
And I think that's important information for us to take back to our committee, because it certainly is a cost-effective program, both of them cost-effective programs.
Well, Madam Chair, that was one of the things, I mean, Paul hit the issue on 3194, and, you know, we passed that during the session. The different counties have, a majority of them have clearly sent in their applications to the Criminal Justice Commission to get the $15 million there to kind of... Bend County and Linn County for our two counties that we deal with. I've been tracking them pretty much. But one of the things, Paul, that I've been wanting to see happen is more of the transitional thing for the housing side of it and everything. And I appreciate Margaret, too, because we've talked about that, too, a little bit more at length. So this has really been kind of neat to listen to all this and tie in it. What we've done in Linn County was actually set aside $30,000 toward that, for the housing for transition, and we're going to see how that works out. And there's a plan that's going to be placed in the issue, but we'll just kind of see how it works out.
We'll follow up. Yeah. Thank you all for coming. Thank you,
Thank you. Best of luck to you.
Now we're going to be hearing about manufactured housing community sale, the work group update. Representative Nancy Nathanson, Representative Wisnett, his wife's mother died, and he is at that funeral, so he won't be with us today. But I think I saw John Landingham.
Yeah, John.
John, will you be coming to testify?
Only if you want me to.
Okay. Nancy, it's your call.
If you have questions, how about that?
All right. That sounds fine. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. First of all, I want to thank you, the Chair especially, and the committee for suggesting, for providing us the opportunity and giving us the time to work on what had been House Bill 3007 in the spring session. You gave us time. You said, work on this and try to work it out. We did. Representative Wisnett and I took your advice and your direction very seriously. We convened a work group. We have met over the summer and fall. We've met in person three times for substantive discussions. In addition to that, Representative Wisnett and I visited a resident-owned park in Redmond to talk to the residents there about the circumstances under which they came to purchase the park and what it's like to manage it, to plan the finances, to live there, and how it's going. In addition to our meetings that we've called, each one of us, Representative Wisnett and I, have met separately with one or more of the individual members of the committee to hear additional concerns or ideas and suggestions. Representative Wisnett shared those points with me in front of the group on, I guess it was Tuesday when we last met, to make sure that this is what we wanted to present to you and how we wanted to characterize it. We have worked hard. Representative Wisnett said, We think we can get there, and it seems we have. I'm very pleased to report to you that we have worked on a couple of major ways of presenting a new proposal to you. And since Tuesday, we have prepared a new draft. There were two drafts that the work group considered very carefully on Tuesday. We picked a direction to go that we think can work. On Tuesday, as we were discussing in detail the components of that, and by the way, we weren't trying to write legal language. We know that that's the job for legislative counsel, but it had very specific ideas in it about what points it should include. As we were discussing those, there were a few new ideas that came up. Well, should we say it this way or that way? And there was one major concern brought by park owners, and that one was addressed. Everyone agreed, yes, take that out. It's an item of concern. We don't have to do it that way. There's another way to do it. So, since that meeting, a new draft has been proposed of what our concepts would include. I want to tell you, I guess, in general, what this new concept is about. It's an alternative proposal that looks very different from House Bill 3007, but it accomplishes the same general purpose. And I want to tell you how it's different from House Bill 3007. Two major ways. First of all, it is much simplified. It was suggested in our group, oh, by the way, I apologize, I should tell you who's been participating in this work group. We've had a representative from CASA of Oregon, representative from Oregon Housing Alliance. Both of those, you might say, are on the resident or tenant side. We've also had John Van Lanningham on the resident or tenant side. And then representing park owners and their representatives or attorneys, we've had a number of people, an attorney for the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We've had a California-based landlord, an attorney and lobbyist for the Oregon Park Owners Alliance, another three members from the Oregon Park Owners Alliance, and another person representing California landlords. So we've had a number of people with a very hands-on approach, people with very specific experience. They know how parks are bought and sold and managed, and they also represent the interests of the people who live in the parks. So a very hands-on type of work group. So one of the suggestions was, this is too complicated, it's too much, why don't you try a much simpler approach? This approach is much simplified. Also, it's a different approach. It's no longer trying to come at this from the perspective of landlord-tenant law, and instead, it's along the lines of what is real-world standard commercial real estate business transaction. It turns out that that's one way to achieve things that's much more comfortable for park owners and people representing parks to deal with, instead of the landlord-tenant law approach. So this has been characterized, and I've heard both sides say it now, both sides being uncomfortable, but then getting to a point where they say each side has given up quite a bit, and they both have looked at this and said this can work. So that, to me, looks like we're on the road to something that can work for everybody. One very specific example to tell you. The time period in question had covered 100 days. It's now reduced to 25 days. So that was a huge, huge, very specific difference to illustrate. One concept that remains that has been very important for people who are interested in buying a park and they're in a hurry because they have a 1031 exchange deadline looming, those transactions continue to be exempt. in creating this very simplified approach, not every procedure or action in a series of transactions is addressed or described in detail. But the group still feels generally comfortable that in this straightforward manner, even though it doesn't try to be specific and clear on every single permutation of possibility, that it will work for both sides. For example, the residents have to show they have, the phrase is skin in the game. They have to show that they are making the effort, that it's bona fide, that it's legitimate, and this isn't just some sort of a stalling or nuisance action. To protect owners and landlords from either nuisance or inappropriate delays, they have a really simple remedy. Kill the sale. Just stop, and it's not going to happen. I would like to make sure that we all remember that this isn't about a goal that every single park in Oregon will remain a manufactured home park forever in perpetuity. That's not what this is about. It also isn't assuming that every group of residents is able to or even wants to purchase their park. All this is simply clarifying how it can happen that if a park owner is going to put a park up for sale, how is it that residents would be notified, and how can residents come together very quickly to indicate their interest and make an offer? So I'm very pleased that we got to this point. We've worked hard and pretty quickly, frankly, and I'm very pleased that what we have now is we have forwarded to you electronically, and we also have available on paper copies, a copy of what the most recent framework is, and that's what we would have ready to send to Legislative Council.
Good job, Representative. Great job.
Any questions?
Representative Kenny Guy.
Okay, just quickly, this is fabulous that you've done this, and I remember the two issues that stood out in my mind were the timing and the confidentiality, so I know you've addressed that, and I look forward to seeing the bill. Is it a committee bill, or is it your...
It's a committee bill. It would be a committee bill. Okay. Right. Yes.
Great.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions? I'm sorry. Anybody else need to testify, speak on this?
Yes, I would.
Yes. Sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Van Lanningham, Lane County Legal Aid. First, the main thing I want to do is thank the chair and the committee for essentially telling this group to find a compromise. And then Representatives Nathanson and especially Representative Wisnett, who had to work very hard to encourage a compromise. We have compromised a lot. In getting there, I would note that I think I owe a lot personally to Chuck Carpenter of MHCO, who's in the audience, the main, by far, the largest landlord group in the state, and its lawyer, Phil Quarin, somebody that I worked with for years. There are some things we still will need to hammer out. I trust that they are committed, as I am, to finding a compromise. If we need to compromise further, we will find a compromise. We will make this work. Not all landlords are going to support this. You're going to hear, by February, you're going to hear an opponent with a lobbyist saying this is a bad idea. I'm telling you that the rest of us, the majority of us, landlords and tenants, think this is difficult, but the right way to go. Thank you.
I know you've worked hard on this for years. Any other comments from anyone? Question? Great. Thank you so much. So you'll be working with our staff to work on a committee bill. Terrific.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. And I noticed people here, some young people that we haven't seen before. Are you here for any specific reason, or are you just here to observe what we do in this committee? Would anyone, and I want a child, not an adult, to answer that question. Any young person here would like to answer why, tell us why you're here? Please do. Come on. Can you come up, honey? Right here. Thank you for being brave.
We're, like, here on a field trip.
Great. From what school?
We go to Arbor School.
Which is where?
It's a private school in Tualatin.
That's great.
Ben Cannon's
her name. Oh, give us your name, please, honey.
My name's Beatrice Pickett.
Thank you, Beatrice. Great. Oh, you're getting your picture taken already. And actually, your family will be able to stream this, on, and so you'll be able to get it at home to see that you were the brave one who came up to speak. The first time I spoke in front of a committee like this, my hands were shaking like this. So I sort of know what that feels like. But thank you for coming, dear. You're welcome. And other people who would like to speak on any issue, we have about 13 minutes. Anybody else who wants to speak on any issue? Oh, you're leaving. Bye-bye.
Next meeting.
Yes, no. Patty.
Tell them.
Too many Christmas.
Thank you. Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And actually, John Mullen and I were thinking in the back how important it was for the panel on the individuals who were incarcerated who had come out and were able to get those wonderful services. Yeah. And there was a question about how difficult it was to get the SSI. And I just want to reiterate that we discontinued our general assistance program in 2005, and there's still a great need for that support system to help stabilize. It's great to have some of the, the nonprofits and garnering both federal and state dollars. We could do a little bit. We could do more. If there were a general assistance program, we could help a lot more of those individuals get stabilized.
As long as I'm chair, we will keep hearing that message.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, thank you for bringing that issue up and keeping it on the radar screen. I know that you're also going to be meeting this afternoon, the Senate Bill 450 meeting, and I'm hopeful that there'll be some discussion there, and still hopeful that the bill concept that we had in 2013, House Bill 2712, will have an opportunity to be considered along with the special purpose appropriation from the special session. It's a very modest amount of money, but getting us on the right track of thinking about whether the best ways to fill gaps in services will be very important. So we'll look forward to opportunities to talk about it again. But thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Patty. Peter.
Oh, Madam Chair, look what you've done. Now you've brought Peter up here, too, now. I mean, Christmas.
She asked. I promise you brief, and I won't practice my translation skills. But you know, as I listened to some of the testimony on folks coming out of the prison system, we have a small program. We work with Community Action Agency using the IDA program to help folks settle out. And I think the IDA program could be a great tool to help match some federal dollars. The folks are working in the prisons. They've got earned income. We can use those matches. And I just think there's some real interesting opportunities to help folks get settled out. It's going to require not using those three regular asset classes. It's going to require, probably setting up some rental subsidy for when they get out. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out.
Thank you.
Wait.
Can I say something?
You need to see your name, Peter.
I'm sorry. Peter Heenley, CASA of Oregon, Sherwood.
Thank you. Wait a minute, please. I will call on you.
Okay.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. No, I just wanted to point out, actually, it was my colleague, Representative Gilliam, that made the comment that the stabilization, it just seemed like such a variable that just runs through all of these stories. As we can stabilize folks, it just seems to make such a difference.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can't speak for yourself, Representative Gilliam.
He said that.
You're a speaker. Yes, Representative Kenny Gunn.
Thank you. Well, I can't help but make the connection from the very first testimony we heard on the Early Learning Council and their decision over a pretty short process to decide not to have any capital construction, and then the whole rest of the meeting was about that being an important piece of the picture. So I just wanted to make a comment on that, but I also want to say that so much of today was about giving back, that the way in which the state and in partnership with other public entities and private entities has given to people, but they feel this tremendous sense of obligation and pride and giving back. And that just came through every single testimony with every single issue, and it was really heartening because so much of what we hear is often the need, and it sometimes is kind of depressing because we can't meet all the need. But today, to me, was so uplifting in how this turns people's lives around. So that's just what came through very strong
today. Thank you for articulating that. Anything else?
Yes,
I will try to speak for myself.
Sorry.
wait.
It may not be for this group, but I am very encouraged by the stories we heard. And you've heard me sing this song before. It's incredible what the nonprofit community is doing. I'm glad we're partnering in certain funds. But when they step up as people come out, I think that's where the personal part comes in, and a far greater success rate. The last time we met, it probably is not a purview for our committee. You were bragging about being on another great big committee. It's probably judiciary, but the state's responsibility to run prisons has a great deal to do with what's happening to people. And I'm not, I will repeat what I said then, I think we have a lot more work to do investigating what's happening to people while they're in prison. It'll make the job of people coming out much easier. It'll make the job of transition much better. But their lives, you're not supposed to go in prison and have a vacation. I understand that. Their lives are becoming increasingly more complicated and worse for being in prison. So all I'm saying is that's where, in my view, as state legislators, that's where we need to also, I'm not saying only, also focus, and then also partnering with the nonprofits as they come out. So we talked about that, and it's a long list of things we're looking at. I don't know if that's on our list for February. And to pivot for a second and ask, do you have an update for us on committee bills? Or maybe I missed, maybe you did it at the beginning. For February,
We have been Debbie. We've been asked a question about other committee bills. Help me remember those, if you would, please.
Gambling.
Yes, gambling addiction.
Okay. That we something about low-income housing and taxes that the Catholic Charities need about a
right.
tax.
Yeah, right.
And then Representative Mason?
Yeah, so those would be our three bills.
The deadline's coming up, and I'd love to talk to you offline, but just sure. to make sure, as you know, this committee's been very helpful with the two elder abuse prevention bills.
Yes.
And I'm looking for a home for number three for February. So.
Okay, thank you. We will do walk and talk offline. Anything else?
Thank you all for staying for 3 long hours. I really appreciate it. You're a good committee. Thank you so much. With that, we will close the House.
Good chair.
House Human Services and Housing Committee. Thanks to all. House Human Services and Housing Committee. Thanks to all.